Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Okay, as far as Gus talking about Obama, about disgruntled people getting all their anger and frustration out on this president, consider me one of those. I know that Obama's not in charge, but the fact is that he has gone along with this program, and he knew in the beginning that he was going to be doing this to his people. I don't have any love for him, and as far as Pam's analogy, that time of comparing him to a car or a horse or whatever, a car is an inanimate object. They don't. It doesn't have any feelings or whatever. Obama knows exactly what the hell he was doing when he signed up for this job. He knew he was going to be in a position where he was going to be mistreating his people. A lot of non-white people, a lot of non-black people with white parents are like that, and I don't forgive him, and I just don't like him, and you know, and if that is a bad thing, I really don't care, because that's just the way I feel about him. I just think he's scum, and if I was his wife, I would be ashamed to be married to him. I mean,
wow.
I mean, it just makes me angry. I mean, I expect this crap from white folks, but I mean, from somebody that's supposed to be even part black and doing this to their people and knowing that they were set up to do this crap, you know, and the way he was acting at Mandiba's funeral, the way he was taking selfies with those white people and stuff, laughing, I mean, it's just... To me, he's just no good.
Damn you, Obama.
This was the scene at the White House 10 years ago today.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
That was President Barack Obama signing the Affordable Care Act into law. Julie Rovner covered the law's passage and implementation for NPR back then, and she is now at our partner Kaiser Health News. She's with us to talk about how the ACA has changed healthcare in the past decade and also how the current coronavirus pandemic might change the Affordable Care Act. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Ari. Thanks for having me.
So much of the Affordable Care Act is about access to health insurance. Is it making a difference in this coronavirus outbreak?
Well, it is, although not in the way you might think. The health law was mostly about health insurance. Around 20 million more people have insurance than had it before the law was passed. And that insurance means that doctors and hospitals and clinics have all gotten paid over the past several years that might not have otherwise if those people had remained uninsured. It's kept some hospitals open that otherwise would have closed. Meanwhile, other parts of the law shored up other parts of the healthcare system, particularly things like making preventive care more available and boosting the supply of health professionals. So I think it's safe to say that while the health system is not ready to weather the coming storm if things get really, really bad, it would have been so much worse if not for the Affordable Care Act.
Remind us what the healthcare system looked like before this law passed. What were the biggest problems?
Well, there were two big problems. Healthcare cost too much, which it still does, although for other reasons, and too many people didn't have, and many of them couldn't get health insurance. For example, back in 2008, I spoke to Barb Fleming. She's a self-employed saleswoman from Missouri with individual insurance who was diagnosed with breast cancer. Her insurer wouldn't renew her policy because it didn't have to. And while she was able to get into her state's high-risk pool, that coverage wasn't very helpful.
I was approved for the pool as of March 4th, which is the day I needed insurance, but it would not cover my cancer. So I was going to be paying $908 a month for an insurance, and I have been, that was not covering the cancer.
Wow.
So the Affordable Care Act did solve that problem by requiring that insurance cover pre-existing conditions. It also did other things to boost coverage, like outlawing lifetime dollar limits on medical care and letting parents keep adult children on their health plans until they reach age 26.
So by late 2009, the first year of the Obama presidency, Democrats had a large majority in the House. They had 60 votes in the Senate. Those numbers suggest that it might have been easy for them to pass this law, but it wasn't. Why not?
Well, Democrats as well as Republicans have long had internal splits over what to do about health care. And while a lot of the groundwork was laid for this law even before President Obama was elected, Democrats still argued over big issues like whether to include a public health plan people could sign up for. That's the so-called public option. And the issue that almost derailed the bill several times, abortion. The goal of the sponsors was to make the law what they called abortion neutral, so to neither expand nor contract abortion rights. But actually, writing that goal into the legislation turned out to be incredibly difficult.
Okay, so the law passes and President Obama signs it on March 23rd, 2010. And it seems like since then it has been having constant near-death experiences.
Yes, that is absolutely true. The law has been on the edge of elimination several times. The first big threat was a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the requirement for most Americans to either have insurance or pay a fine, the so-called individual mandate. That went to the Supreme Court in 2012. And to the surprise of many, it was upheld with the pivotal vote of Chief Justice John Roberts. Here was President Obama on that June day.
The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do, what the country can't afford to do, is refight the political battles of 2 years ago.
Well, of course, that's not what happened.
Right.
Most Republican governors refused to cooperate in their states. They didn't set up their own insurance marketplaces. They wouldn't do any marketing so people could know that insurance was available and affordable. They could get subsidies if they signed up. But most critically, at least in the first years, most of them didn't expand the Medicaid program for people with low incomes, which the Supreme Court ruling had made optional. So even right now in some really big states like Texas and Florida, there are millions of people who were supposed to be able to get Medicaid coverage under the law, but instead are still uninsured.
So in 2016, Donald Trump runs for president, and he promises to get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
Obamacare has to be repealed and replaced, and it has to be replaced with something much less expensive for the people. And otherwise, this country is in even bigger trouble than anybody thought.
It was not repealed and replaced, but the Trump administration did weaken the law. So how strong is the Affordable Care Act today?
Well, it has weathered an awful lot of storms, and there's yet another lawsuit that the Supreme Court will hear in the next term that could, again, get the entire law struck down. It was brought by a group of Republican state attorneys general. Ironically, the Trump administration is supporting that lawsuit, even as the Affordable Care Act is being used right now to lessen the impact of the coronavirus crisis.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the relationship between the ACA and coronavirus. I mean, you've mentioned that millions more people have health insurance now than otherwise would. How else is the ACA being used to fight this outbreak?
Well, at least 9 states have reopened their Affordable Care Act marketplaces to help enroll people who didn't sign up for insurance and now think they might want it. I should point out that if you lose your job and your health insurance, you're automatically entitled to sign up for coverage mid-year under the law. Meanwhile, California announced Friday that its exchange, which had been open for reasons unrelated to the outbreak, will continue to allow residents to enroll through June because of the upheaval caused by the coronavirus. The Trump administration could choose to reopen enrollment nationwide if it wanted to, and there are reports it's considering doing just that.
You know, the health system is under such duress right now. What does the future of the Affordable Care Act look like in light of what the health system is going through with the coronavirus outbreak?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, despite its name, the Affordable Care Act did a lot more to fix problems with insurance coverage than it did to actually make health care affordable. 10 years later, people are still complaining about premiums and copays and surprise medical bills. People still declare bankruptcy because of medical bills. And most significantly for this crisis, many people with insurance say they still avoid seeking medical care because they worry about what it might cost. And public health experts say that's a big problem and one you're not seeing in most of the other countries dealing dealing with the crisis at the same time. What you don't want is Americans with coronavirus not getting tested or seeking care if they should, and then spreading the virus to others. I think there are also going to be long-term political ramifications to this crisis. I'm already hearing the I told you so's from advocates for a single-payer system, the Medicare for All proponents. People are asking why we can't have faster and better testing like South Korea. And one reason is that they have a single streamlined national health system compared to our fragmented non-system. So I think when this is all over, Americans and public officials are going to have a very different attitude about our healthcare system and what it should do and who should pay for it. And I think it really could change the debate very profoundly.
That is Julie Rovner, a familiar voice to NPR listeners. She is now chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News. It's great to talk to you again, Julie. Thanks.
Thank you.
Why haven't you learned anything?
In addition to the lost lives and the thousands of people who have fallen ill from the coronavirus, the country, and especially Charlotte, lost a legendary figure this month. On March 8th, the Reverend Darius Swan died at the age of 95 from pneumonia. Swan's name is attached to one of the most important court decisions regarding education and desegregation, Swan versus Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education. The 1969 lower federal court ruling and the 1971 Supreme Court decision in Swan paved the way for busing in Charlotte as a way to desegregate public schools. By 1980, Charlotte schools had integrated at an unprecedented level and were looked upon by cities across the country as a model to use in desegregating the nation's public schools. Historian and author Pamela Grundy picks up the story there.
The Swan really believed in integrated education, and so when they returned to Charlotte, which they did very deliberately in order to become part of the struggle. There's a story that when they were in India, they saw the picture of Dorothy Counts where she attempted to integrate Harding High School, and they knew her father, Reverend Counts, who was a professor at Johnson C. Smith.
Which is where he graduated and went to theology school, Johnson C. Smith.
Correct. And I believe the Swans also met at Johnson C. Smith. So they had real connections with the Counts. And this was a moment of seeing Dorothy and seeing what was happening in Charlotte. It was an important moment for them, and they determined that they would need to go back to the U.S. to participate in this unfolding struggle. And Reverend Swan got a position at Johnson C. Smith and then attempted to enroll their young son in an integrated school. They attempted to send him to the school that was closest to their house, which was a historically white school.
That was Seversville Elementary School.
Yes, that was Seversville Elementary School. It'd been a white school, and they wanted to send their son there, not just because it was the closest, but really because they believed in integration. They wanted him to go to an integrated school. They were told he could not go there. He would have to go to a historically black school much farther away. They were dissatisfied with this, and that was what helped them, you know, decide to become part of the lawsuit.
And my understanding at that time, this was in 1965, that only 2% of African Americans in Charlotte were enrolled in integrated schools. So this was a big thing.
This was a big thing. Many African Americans had been attempting to enroll their children in historically white schools. So essentially every year a number of African American families would ask that their children be admitted to white schools, and the school board would find all sorts of excuses why that just wasn't possible.
And to do this at this time, this was a very courageous thing that they really pushed, because my understanding is their lives were threatened, the lives of their lawyer, Julius Chambers, that this was a time when their lives were threatened because they were trying to integrate the schools.
It was dangerous to challenge the status quo here in Charlotte as well as in other parts of the country. You had death threats. Also, there's all sorts of underneath stuff. You could lose your job. There were a number of Charlotte families who were part of this lawsuit. It was not merely the Swans, but in part because Reverend Swan was employed by Johnson C. Smith, that gave the Swans a little bit of protection. You know, Johnson C. Smith wasn't going to fire him for pressing for integration. So that was helpful. And I believe is part of the reason why they were the lead plaintiff with their name on the lawsuit. But it was still a risk.
In the early 2000s, you met Reverend Swan. Tell us about that.
The time that I met with Swan, I was presenting at a conference, and I was at that point thinking a lot about the resource issue. And then in the back of the room, there's this very gentlemanly man who raises his hand, and he says, "I would just like to say that my name is Reverend Swan, and I did want my child to have those experiences. I really did want them to be learn about other children and other cultures, wanting to be open-minded, wanting to experience the world, understanding that you don't know everything." I think that was very much who he was.
And in terms of Swan, when those decisions were made, the final decision by the Supreme Court, he was not living in Charlotte, but the case itself, it had ramifications nationwide, correct?
Well, the case really was the most far-reaching desegregation case. It was the last great desegregation case. And they created the most desegregated major school system in the country. The Swan case had, in fact, created what the Swans wanted for their children, which was an integrated system where children had more equal education and were also able to interact with each other, able to know each other. And that was so important to them.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Historian and author Pamela Grundy.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Schools are closed in Washington State for at least another month, but the state superintendent of public instruction has ordered districts to start working with all families to get back into learning mode beginning Monday. KUW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld is here to tell us more. Ann, hi.
Hello.
So this guidance from the state is a change from what schools chief Chris Rakedahl first told districts a few weeks ago, right?
It is. Before the entire K-12 system in Washington shut down, Superintendent Rakedahl warned districts that if they closed schools, they should not turn to online learning unless they could guarantee equal access for all students. Not all students have high-speed internet or computers at home, so most districts, including Seattle Public Schools, said that they may offer some enrichment activities during their closure, but that they didn't have the resources or the training to continue classes online. And Seattle has handed out learning packets to students. They're doing some classes on TV, and there's been some online learning going on, but it's been kind of piecemeal.
Right. I understand that Superintendent Rakedahl told districts earlier this week something a little different, that they have to find a way to achieve remote learning. Is that right?
Right. He said that learning has to continue for every student during the 6-week closure and that districts should start getting back in the game on Monday. On a conference call with reporters just a few minutes ago, he said that OSPI does not expect districts to have fully realized distance learning for all students starting on Monday, but that they should at least be figuring out how to deliver services to each student based on that student's needs.
Doing nothing isn't an option. You need to start walking up this curve and delivering learning opportunities for families now that this thing has been shut down, now that we have some additional flexibility from the feds, now that families understand really how significant this timeline may be.
And Rakedahl said he expects school will be back in session on April 27th, but that the state has to plan for everything, including the closure lasting the rest of the school year.
Hmm. All right, a new directive from the state superintendent. And how have districts responded?
Well, it's really sent them scrambling to come up with plans. They've all been doing their own thing so far, and they'll continue to do their own thing. But from very little in some districts has been happening, much more organized remote learning has been going on in some well-resourced districts. In Seattle, which is the state's largest district, Superintendent Denise Juno told KUOW today that the district is working with teachers to develop, quote, a robust learning plan, a new set of expectations that will roll out on Monday. In Seattle, that might be a combination of delivery models, the district says, online, paper, phone office hours, things like that. Juno addressed the criticism that this district has not moved to a fully online model, as some districts have done around the country.
I just need people to know that we have been working on developing plans, that there are a lot of schools I know in the area that are moving forward and have flipped around to attempting online learning. But we are a big system and it just takes us a little while, but we've been trying to be very thoughtful and deliberate and equity focused and student centered as we move this ball forward.
And there are some hurdles that Seattle has faced as it goes through this process, like coming to an agreement with the teachers union about what working looks like now.
Right. The district and Seattle Education Association, the union, signed a memorandum of agreement yesterday that clarified some expectations and boundaries about what's being asked of teachers. Over the past couple of weeks, since schools closed in Seattle, some teachers put together elaborate online lessons and checked in with kids by phone, but other teachers have done very little, some parents say. This agreement requires that teachers continue working through the school closure, that they'll check their email at least intermittently and be available for phone calls during work hours, and that high school teachers will make sure that seniors on track for graduation stay on track. But I spoke to a district staffer who told me that no one has seemed to want to make the first move in Seattle toward a game plan for remote learning, not the district or the union, not the principals union. And this staffer told me that no one wants to be the one to go out on a limb with a plan that will likely upset some faction, whether it's parents or teachers or district leadership. So it's been interesting to watch, he said.
Right. Okay, well, that's Seattle. What are other districts planning in terms of remote learning for next week?
Well, I contacted maybe 15 or 16, and they told me for the most part they're still figuring out their plans. North Shore School District, which was the first one to close for any length, is the furthest along that I've seen. Their plan calls for mostly Monday, Wednesday, Friday school week with a couple hours of online classes each day, then office hours the rest of the day for students to connect with teachers and planning periods for teachers. Many teachers are, of course, home with their own kids right now, so there are, of course, limitations to what they can accomplish.
Right, which you know all about. Well, districts have to keep in mind their legal responsibilities when it comes to equitable student learning, right?
Yes, especially the 14% of Washington students with disabilities they need to keep in mind. Federal law requires the districts ensure that students are served regardless of disability, but online lessons can be inaccessible to students with some disabilities. So districts need to get creative on several levels to make sure they're meeting all students' needs to the best of their abilities, or they could face potential lawsuits down the road.
KUOW education reporter Ann Dornfeld on the new requirements for the state schools. Thank you so much for this.
You're welcome.
I would like to begin by announcing some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all. No, not at all. It comes from China.
Along with all the other forms of stress and fear that Americans feel right now, Asian Americans feel one more. Prejudice, driven by the news that the virus was first detected in China.
It comes from China.
Russell Jung is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University, and he set up a website to compile reports of discrimination. When we reached him, at home, of course, in Oakland, California, he told of an incident in a local park.
So my wife was walking on a trail in a regional park, and this person was approaching her, and they could see each other. She moved to the side, but the person moved in front of her. She called out. He didn't respond, but when she passed him, he coughed at her. So we don't know if it's intentional or unintentional, but this type of coughing at people and spitting at people, it's something that Asians are actually experiencing a lot more.
So the spitting is pretty obviously a hostile act. And I suppose in a time when people are worried about contagion, coughing on someone would probably be seen just the same way.
Yeah, it is. And so if you do get spit on you, that's actually a physical assault. And in San Francisco, we're getting reports now on our reporting center, and 10-15% of the reports are about physical assault of people getting either physically attacked or being spat upon or coughed at.
What is the database that you've been gathering, and why did you start?
So we've recognized early on that people were experiencing a lot of bullying, a lot of shunning, a lot of avoiding when the coronavirus outbreak occurred. And we didn't have any hard data to document what was going on. So the first thing we did was we looked at news trends, and we counted news stories that had coronavirus and discrimination or xenophobia in it. We found hundreds of articles about policies that people thought were xenophobic, economic boycotts of Asian businesses, and then later on about interactions that Asian Americans were having where people were bullying, taunting, harassing, and now attacking. We had hundreds of accounts to go to the state legislature and say, this is happening, we need to get it documented, we need to proactively address these trends. And since the government didn't have the capacity in California, we started our own website as a reporting center, and it just was launched last week. And we've been getting over 100 reports every day.
100 reports every day. What are some of the things that, I don't know, have come in today or the last time you looked?
Most are verbal harassment, name-calling, that people would just be walking by and people would yell out, coronavirus is because of you, or they would fake cough in front of people. So name-calling and just verbal harassment, microaggressions were the most common. Moves up to people having bottles and cans thrown at them, their homes being vandalized. And then regularly, maybe 3 times a day, we have people actually being physically attacked, assaulted, being hit or punched, pushed on subways. We've noticed that women, for example, are 3 times more likely to be attacked than men. And so this is a very gendered experience. And we wouldn't – well, I wasn't expecting that. It's clear now that we can see through the trends that people are now getting into conflict a lot more at grocery stores because every other place is locked down. So grocery stores are where we're interacting with other people.
Do you think about this trend when you go out of the house and you're moving around and someone's approaching you on the street? Do you think about what that encounter might be like?
Yeah, now more than ever, I think Asian Americans are hyper aware and sensitive of how other people perceive them. I think what's sad is a lot of children and youth are afraid of being bullied, and that type of racial profiling and that experience of having people not trust you, having people look at you as a disease carrier, I think that's on a lot of people's minds in the Asian American community.
Do you feel you understand why people are doing this?
Oh, it's easy to understand. It's been part of Americans' racist history. It's easy to understand if you take into context how President Trump has incited and fomented xenophobia. It's easy to understand when people have heightened fears because of the disease. It's part of a person of color's experience already. And so we call it coronavirus discrimination, and racial profiling is to be expected, actually.
Are there things that have happened that have made it worse, though?
You know, after 9/11, people were attacking Muslim Americans, and President Bush came out and said, we have to not discriminate or mistreat Muslim Americans. What President Trump did was he insisted on calling it the Chinese virus and labeling coronavirus as a racial disease. And by othering Asians, and it's not just Chinese, anybody who looks Chinese, it just gave people a license to attack us, to blame us for the disease, to say we're the source of it. And it's not the people who are the source of the disease. It's just a virus that doesn't discriminate.
Did the president help at all this week by insisting in a briefing that it is not the fault of Chinese Americans, whatever has happened?
Yeah, we appreciate that. I think that was due to the pressure that we've exerted and the complaining. But I think it's a little too late. He's already opened the door to this racism. It was already starting even before he made the China virus remarks, and he just sort of exacerbated the situation. But, you know, he still uses this us versus them binary that argues that, oh, we're really working with them. We're protecting them, that we're still outsiders and foreigners and not part of the American fabric.
What do you want from political leaders and from your fellow citizens?
From our political leaders, it starts from the top. We need to say we don't condone prejudice in any forms. So we want the government to actually be proactive and address racism rather than responding to it. And from our fellow citizens, you just have to check your biases when you approach an Asian American. You have to be aware that, oh, I may automatically assume something that I shouldn't automatically assume. Yeah, treat people with a space now and then also the dignity and courtesy that we all need to have during this public health crisis.
Russell Jung is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University, and he joined us via Skype. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And don't hit the females. Now, the females can cooperate with this and kind of push it along by, when everything is going fine, when you first meet this fella, that you think you really like, and you're going to start spending some time with him. And when you all are sitting somewhere with the candlelight and roses, if that's the setting, or wherever, in the apartment, in the car, and you're really talking about how much you really go for each other and all the rest of that stuff that you half believe, okay? The female should speak up and say, Johnny, I want to tell you something that's very, 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 very important to me. And we've been seeing each other about a month now. Don't ever hit me. Now, if you hit me, there's nothing I can do because you're much bigger than me. You're muscular. You play basketball and all like this. But don't ever hit me because what that will mean is that we can never be together again. For any reason, if you ever hit me. Now, I might say some things that might make you mad. Or I might do some things that might make you mad. Hopefully not. But whatever happens, I want you to say that you, and get it in your mind that you will never hit me. Because I can't stand for you to hit me. And it won't prove anything if you hit me.
With so many Americans now staying home, the pandemic continues to have a major effect on nearly all aspects of our lives. But one area getting less attention is how that isolation can exacerbate the problem of domestic violence. John Yang has a closer look.
Judy, in past times of stress like 9/11, the economic downturn of 2008, and Hurricane Katrina, experts say that the intensity and frequency of domestic abuse has gone up. Katie Ray Jones is the CEO of the National Domestic Violence Hotline. She joins us by Skype from Austin, Texas. Katie, thanks so much for being with us. In the current situation, the current environment, what concerns you most? What are you most worried about?
Yeah, I think for us, John, what we're most worried about at the National Domestic Violence Hotline is knowing that many victim survivors are currently living in isolation with their abusive partner, and their ability to seek help or guidance is significantly limited, knowing that oftentimes abusive partners are observing phone calls or watching what material someone might be looking at on their device. So we're really concerned right now, knowing that history has shown us with an increased severity of abuse and increased frequency of abuse, that many survivors are currently in dire situations.
To what extent is this social distancing to try to stop the virus spreading contributing or aiding or abetting people who commit this violence and abuse?
It's a great question. What we know is that oftentimes abusive partners will leverage something happening in society as a further means to isolate, create fear, intimidate, or coerce a victim. We have already started to hear stories from survivors who are reaching out to the hotline who are indicating that their abusive partner has indicated that they can't go to work, they can't see family, they can't see friends as a means to what they feel is further isolate them and leveraging COVID-19 as a means to do that. We've already heard some really distressing stories where one woman shared that, you know, her community where she's currently residing does not have shelter in place protocols. Her employer was indicating it was safe for her to go to work, and her abusive partner essentially said, "You're not going." And when she stated she was, he actually took the firearm out in their home and began to load the firearm. And she said that this is not something he had ever done, that they have an abusive relationship, but he had never brought a firearm out before. And this was causing her really great concern. So we know that at times when there's fear, misinformation in society, that oftentimes people who have control issues, power issues, they may exasperate those dynamics in their abusive relationship.
How is this complicating your work? For instance, are shelters operating? Are they worried about social distancing in that sense, too?
Yeah, so we've already seen our ability to even connect some survivors to shelters or exit strategies be greatly impacted. We know shelters are going to great lengths to deeply sanitize shelters, keep existing residents safe. So it absolutely makes sense that one's ability to continue to do intakes, to take in new clients may be limited. We've heard from survivors who were really holding out for their custody hearing, their divorce hearing, or a protective order hearing, that those are being impacted. So a lot of the dynamics in terms of systems that survivors rely on, and what we would say many of the tools that we're keeping in a survivor's toolbox, feel like they're disappearing rapidly. And so that's really concerning on top of what might be happening in their home already.
And talk about, you mentioned this before, but I want you to expand on it. The idea that when you're isolated with someone who may be abusing you, you can't necessarily call the hotline and seek help.
Yeah, I think that is one of the most distressing things about this. We know and we hear from survivors pre-COVID-19 that their behaviors were being monitored down to spyware being installed on their computers and watching what they're looking at in terms of material online. So when you're in close proximity to someone, having the ability to make a phone call and sharing the very intimate details of an abusive relationship may be really significantly impacted, which is why we're really trying to encourage friends, family, neighbors to contact the hotline and get information about resources, safety planning strategies that might be available for someone, because you may be their only lifeline right now to information and help and even emotional support.
And with social distancing, could it be that people don't know that it's going on? People, friends, or neighbors may not know and may not know to call to reach out for help?
Yeah, I think oftentimes domestic violence is the secret that happens behind closed doors and it's not our problem. And so we're really encouraging folks to understand that right now we need everybody to be activated, to be aware of what's happening around them. So if they are hearing sounds coming out of their neighbor's house, being thoughtful about what that might mean. Now, sometimes calling the police may not be an option. You know, the hotline's here to serve anyone who is concerned about someone if they themselves are not directly being impacted. So really encouraging people to get educated and leverage the hotline as a resource to increase your knowledge about safety planning, because you may be safety planning with your neighbor right now.
Are there similar concerns about abuse against and violence against children as against people, partners in intimate relationships?
Yes. And so while our mission is really focused on intimate partner violence, we have had individuals reach out indicating concerns with abuse happening at home towards children, and we're providing support around that area as well. The other piece we know is that children are often leveraged in abusive relationships. And so kids can be often in the midst of a violent situation where things might be being thrown and the kids accidentally get in the crossfire of what's happening. So we're wanting to safety plan around kids in the home as well and what that might be looking like, really taking the whole family as a unit to think through what safety planning in place is possible, what exit strategies may be available to a survivor, as well as safety planning for kids.
Katie Ray Jones, CEO of the National Domestic Violence Hotline, thank you very much. And for anyone in our audience, if you or someone you know is experiencing abuse, please call the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E, that's 1-800-799-7233.
What they give you, blood?
3 months, man.
What you doing in here anyway? You ought to be home with your mama. How old are you, boy?
13.
Damn. The bastards must be running out of niggas to arrest.
And now the danger the coronavirus poses to people who are incarcerated. This issue is starting to blow up nationwide. Correction facilities throughout the U.S. are slowly releasing inmates to avoid a potential public health catastrophe. Correctional workers and inmates around the nation are testing positive for the virus. Here in New York, the city has begun to release some prisoners. So have other states like California, Ohio, and New Jersey. New Jersey plans to release up to 1,000 people today. I'm joined by two advocates close to this issue who are calling for the immediate release of more people detained on Rikers Island. Robert Cohen is a medical doctor, a corrections health expert, and New York City Board of Corrections commissioner. And Jose Saldana is the director of the Release Aging People in Prison campaign. Robert and Jose, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us.
Can you each start with your background a little bit and explain your connection to this issue? Jose, you want to?
Sure. I'm formerly incarcerated. I was released a little over 2 years ago after 38 years of incarceration. And this virus is going to kill some of the men that I left behind that should have been walking out with me, but instead they languished for more years in incarceration when they should. they should be with their families as I am enjoying life with my family.
Also, people you're saying who had become aged and weren't a threat and may have been a danger, in more danger of becoming ill in the correction system.
Yeah, yes, let me give you a very brief background that since Governor Cuomo took office, there has been reported 675 elder people 50 and over have died at the alarming young age of 58 years old. Now, this is because not only the substandard health care, but just the aging in prison. You know, we age differently in prison. And now comes a deadly virus that all health experts say is fatal to the very group that's already dying at a young age.
Robert?
So my concern, yes.
Go ahead, you can finish.
My concern is that these men that I left behind will not survive this virus. It will not survive this health crisis.
Robert Cohen, Dr. Cohen, what's your connection to this issue, and what are you seeing?
Well, I've been working in the New York City jails for a long time. I was the director of the medical and mental health services during the early 1980s when the AIDS epidemic first came to the city, starting in 1981 through 86. And I have monitored jails and prisons throughout the country for federal courts. And for the past 10 years, I have been appointed by the city council to the 9-member New York City Board of Correction, which has oversight responsibility for the jails. What I'm concerned about is that the jails need to the jails are not removing the people who need to be removed. The main approach to this epidemic in New York City right now to be discharged as many people as possible. There are 550 people or so in city sentenced category. That means that they were convicted of minor crimes, possession of drugs, disorderly conduct, things that are not a problem to anyone, and they could be released immediately. And the mayor has complete control over that under state law, yet has only released a small number of people and has been asking the police department to review whether or not these people are safe enough to go out when they are only on city sentence because they were convicted of minor offenses. That's 550 people who could be and should be released immediately that the mayor can do, and he's done almost nothing so far in that population. And of those who have been those who are being considered for release, only a small number of those, about 15 or 20, are over 50. The other group that's critical to release are people who are seriously ill. And no effort has been done to address this yet. They are at risk of dying, as Jose said, and nobody should die in jail. But in particular, they are going to get very sick if they get infected. Right now, they're not the people in the infirmaries. But if they get infected because the virus spreads within the jails, it's going to overwhelm the healthcare system, and the security and clinical staff who are doing an extraordinary job are going to be overwhelmed by that situation. Additionally, the governor, through the commissioner of parole and corrections, acting commissioner Annucci, there are over 1,000 people on Rikers Island right now who are there for technical parole violations. They didn't commit crimes. They just broke rules. And because of the state policy, they have been put back in jail. These people can be released immediately by the state, by Commissioner Annucci. Just takes their remand status and changes it. And those groups of people and then there's one other group, which are people who are older, and that's over 50. And that is a group which is an incredible risk of getting very sick and dying from this virus, and will also completely overwhelm the system. So getting people out is the most important thing.
Jose, I thought it might be useful for you to describe for the many listeners who've never been inside a jail what it's like, because people may have this casual impression from television or whatever that it's cell by cell, one person at a time, and they're kind of separated anyway. So why would the virus spread so much in that context. And, you know, and their contact with each other would be restricted as a matter of their incarceration. So can you describe more what it's really like?
Well, the prisons that I've been in, I spent 38 years in maximum security prisons, and this is cell blocks. You know,
that's not Rikers Island, but go ahead.
No, it's upstate. We're talking about state prisons.
I understand.
This is cell blocks that, you know, they're side by side by side. We're talking about 300-400 people in one block, close quarters. Someone gets sick, just about everybody on that company will get sick. Now, in the medium facilities, you have what they call dormitory-style living quarters. You have 60, 70, 80 people in a dormitory-style living quarters. Close quarters again, no ventilation. Someone gets sick, everybody gets sick. So, this virus breathes in environments like this. So we're talking, you know, experts are predicting that in prisons, because first, the substandard health conditions, most people in prison face a health condition just about every day for years and decades.
Dr. Cohn?
This is a prescription.
Go ahead. Yes. You can finish. I apologize. Go ahead.
This is a prescription for death by this virus.
Dr. Cohn, can you describe the New York City jails, Rikers and others in particular, in this respect?
Yes, Brian. There, New York City jails have both cell blocks and dormitory areas. And so in dormitory areas, groups of between, you know, they're built for 50 people, live in close quarters. They share a few toilets and a few showers and a few sinks. And there are times when there are a lot of people gathered within those areas. So the chance for spread is extremely great. The difficulty of achieving distancing of 6 feet is extraordinary. To mitigate the epidemic spread, as few people as possible, and only those people who are absolutely necessary to be on Rikers Island should be there. Lowering the population is also just makes sense in New York. We have 5,300 or so people in jail right now. The city council, the mayor, have agreed that there should only be 3,300 people, and they have passed, you know, legislation, and they have decided to close down Rikers Island and replace it with 3,300 beds, not 5,300 as there are right now. There's no reason to wait 6 years. It's not because people are going to behave better and not get arrested over the next 6 years. It's because there are too many people in our jails and prisons, and we can act right now to get to the point that we need to get to and to save lives. And we shouldn't wait for that right now.
Let's take a phone call. Julia in Spanish Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hi, Julia.
Hi. I love your show. I always listen. I'm just have to say first, our incarceration system is totally inhumane. But I'm curious. I've heard that they have some tested positive. And I was wondering, upon their release, where are they going? And upon release of all they will release, has everyone been tested? Because even everyone out here hasn't been tested. So do they know the level of infection already? And like, where are they going to go? And are the ones that are tested positive, where are they going to go? Or I don't think they're going to hospitals because, well, I won't even say what I think about that. Mm-hmm. So just, are they being provided for as to where they're going to go when they are released?
Dr. Cohn,
they tested everyone?
Yes.
Dr. Cohn, can you answer those questions?
Yes, it would just be like if you or someone you knew were tested positive, they would be told to go home and to quarantine themselves and to isolate themselves for 14 days. That would be the same thing. All of the people who are being considered right now, unfortunately, all of them are healthy. They're not looking at the people who need to be discharged for medical reasons. And you're right that, you know, for some of them who have complicated health and social needs, there will have to be complex discharge planning. I would say that as an example, basically people who are – there are 39 people as of yesterday who were confirmed positive out of 5,500 in the jails. And not everybody has been tested, but but that's how many have been positive. Those people are all housed in the same facility right now, which is the appropriate thing to do. They can't infect each other anymore because they're infected. I would say that for people who are hospitalized and are intensive care units, you know, who come from the jails, they should be discharged because they're really sick if they're in intensive care units, and it requires a large amount of security staff to stay with them 24 hours a day. If the city feels a need to rearrest them, if and when they recover, that would be okay too. But I appreciate your concern, people in jail are just like people out of jail. And if they're positive and they're released, as people are every day, people are released from jail, they will have to self-quarantine.
I think we have another question. And, Julia, thank you for your call.
May I add to that very briefly?
Sure, Jose. Go ahead.
Yes. In New York, in the state prison system, no one is being tested, with few exceptions. The only exceptions are those who show serious symptoms. Everyone else is not being tested. So we really don't know how far the infection has spread in the state prison system. And this is why we are calling for the governor to issue or start the process of releasing people on a clemency process and for a parole board to start releasing people who should have been released years ago and in some cases decades ago. But the thing is that they are not testing.
Here's another caller, I think, on what happens after release. Niles in Georgia. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Niles.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. My call basically speaks to what happens after people are released. So, for example, my dad was in Rikers Island, and through years of going back and sort of recidivism, he ended up developing a mental health issue. And this has more to do with sort of where they're going to go after. But what's going to happen to a large amount of people who are released from jail, and where do they go? And especially for the ones who do suffer from mental illness, what happens to them? Because it's not, I don't believe it's the best thing just to put them back on the street without a proper sort of path to safety, both for the citizens currently and for themselves, and also to reduce the spread of the virus.
Jose, you want to take that question?
Yes. Well, let me begin with what we really cannot do under any circumstances. We cannot leave them in prison to die. That's immoral. Well, what we can do, and there's a perception, and it's a false perception, that those who've languished in prison for decades have no one. No, that's not true. I came home to a family after 38 years of incarceration. I stay connected to my family, and I stay connected to my community, and a lot of us in prison, especially those who've languished in prison for 3 and 4 decades, we have a moral obligation to stay connected to the community that we harm. And we have the obligation to stay connected to our family because we owe everyone something. So that's a perception that we have no one to go to is false. Now, if we begin to release the elderly, those who have conditions where this virus is fatal to, this would save the state millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars that can be allocated for the housing and reentry services. But they are reentry services right now that we're working with in coordination that they will be able to at least provide housing for a vast majority of those that are coming home. And we hope that they will be coming home.
Lauren in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lauren.
Brian, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a public defender in Brooklyn, and I might get a little emotional because I'm talking to people who are on Rikers Island every day, desperately trying to get them out, and we're running into so much red tape. It's just maddening. My clients are all telling me that they're in approximately 50 men dormitory-style rooms. There are people coughing and getting sick all around them. There was just a story of 8 inmates who tried to go to the jail clinic to get their temperatures checked, but they were pepper-sprayed by corrections officers. I have a client who told me they're running out of toilet paper. There's no hand sanitizer. There's very little soap. So the conditions are dire, and I appreciate that a lot of district attorneys are trying to get people out, but it's not enough. And there's an incredible amount of red tape and just ridiculous hurdles to get through to get people out. And
people will die. So I'm kind of at my wit's end over here.
How could it be streamlined most effectively, in your opinion?
I think the DAs need to go further. I think they need to, I know they're looking at cases, you know, individual case by case, but I think they need to be braver and bolder and you know, agree to release more people. And I think, for one example that's very frustrating is extradition cases where people are being held in New York City on either very minor offenses or sometimes just an extradition warrant where they're wanted by another state. And states like Pennsylvania, they're not in any rush to come pick up clients, right? So we have people sitting on Rikers Island who otherwise could be out, but instead we're waiting for these other states to come pick them up. And my guess is it'll be months before those states pick them up. So those are people who I think very obviously should just be released immediately. I think the DA's offices need to consent immediately. That's just one example.
Dr. Cohen, for you,
I'd like to add to and respond to that. I think you're right. I mean, the city is going very slowly. The DA should be much more efficient in this. They shouldn't wait for you to bring their cases to them. They should be reviewing anybody that they have sent to jail right now and see whether or not it would be best for them and safe for them to leave. And the judges should be doing the same thing. Every person in the jail who is there for because they couldn't be bailed out and is not on city sentence is there because a judge ordered them to jail. And they should be reviewing every person that they sent there, and Chief Judge DeFiore should be acting on that also. The quickest way to release about 2,000 people, though, is to take out all the city sentence people.
Yes.
They're for minor crimes, misdemeanors, and minor felonies, and to take all the people who were there only for violating the rules of probation, not for breaking other laws, and release them as well. And there's another population of people who are not eligible for bail right now because they were arrested and charged with a crime, but would have been bailed out, but can't because they're on probation, and therefore it's a technical parole violation. So this is the weight is unreasonable and dangerous, and people will die unnecessarily.
A
couple of thousand people out will make it possible for the doctors and security staff to cope with the work that they are doing.
Lauren, you know who else might have a particular answer for you? Queens City Councilmember Rory Lantzman happens to be calling in. And Councilmember, thank you for calling in. Did you hear the public defender's question and the situation that she's describing and the red tape? Can you help cut through that?
Well, we're trying to, and thank you for having this segment and for having me on. And in my district, I've got a lot of correction officers, but I also have a fair number of people who find themselves on the other side of the bars at Rikers Island. We have been imploring the mayor to use the authority that he has without trying to do a case-by-case analysis with five different district attorneys. That's where the red tape comes in, and then soliciting the NYPD's opinion because the mayor's afraid of doing anything that would cross the police commissioner. As your guests have said, the mayor has the authority to, right now, the stroke of a pen, release about 550 inmates who are serving a sentence of less than a year. These are people that the criminal justice system has already decided are so low risk to the public that they're serving a minor minimal sentence. And that is what needs to be done. The time for using a scalpel is over. The mayor needs to use a hammer, and he needs to release everybody that he can.
You'll never forget me. You want to know why?
What did North Carolina Senator Richard Byrne know, and when did he know it?
That's the question at the center of mounting calls for the Republican senator to resign over allegations of insider trading. Burr chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee and sold off a significant portion of his stock portfolio a week before the U.S. stock market started to slide. Critics say he illegally used information from classified briefings to inform this sale. Burr says he used public news reports to make his portfolio decisions. He's now also facing a shareholder lawsuit. WUNC Capital Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi joins me now to talk about all of it. Jeff, welcome.
Hey there, Anita.
Hope you're faring well, socially distanced, far away from me right now. Reports about Burr's financial decisions came hours after he was already under fire for statements he made about the coronavirus in a private briefing. And I want to start with that clip, and then we'll have you kind of set up all of this for us. So this is a clip that was secretly recorded at a private luncheon on February 27th.
There's one thing that I can tell you about this. It is much more aggressive in its transmission than anything that we have seen in recent history. It's probably more akin to the 1918 pandemic.
So that's a secretly recorded clip of Republican Senator Richard Burr at a private luncheon warning people about the coronavirus 2 weeks before President Donald Trump declared a national emergency. I'm talking with Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi. So we hear him in that clip comparing it to the 1918 pandemic. This is audio of him talking at an exclusive event. And really, some of the controversy here is coming from a contrast between the message he gave to these private donors and the message that he was saying publicly. So take us into this. Take us into this event and the tension between these two statements.
Sure. And that's important. Politicians all the time are altering their messages, and they are they're doing code switching depending on whom it is they're in front of and when and how they're addressing them. But these were starkly different messages, and that has understandably drawn a lot of criticism from folks on both the right and the left. Now, this event that he was speaking at back on February 27th was the Tar Heel Circle, and the Tar Heel Circle it's not a high donor dollar event or high dollar donor event that has been portrayed a little bit in the media, but it is something that insiders have access to. Now, whether that's lobbyists, I've been told that there are congressional staffers that regularly go to these. It's very much a networking thing, but it was here that Senator Burr made this statement about, you know, really needing to heed caution. At the same time, or within in days of that event, he also was penning an op-ed for Fox in which he said the nation has never been better prepared for dealing with a pandemic like this. And while, yes, politicians do code switching and strike different messages with different groups, this was this clearly is an approach that has left a lot of constituents wondering, you know, where has his representation been and where was the warning that kind of never came, if that makes sense.
So, yeah, we had this audio leaked in the morning from NPR. Later that day, ProPublica released a piece about Burr's stock dumping, saying that he sold, you know, close to or up to $1.7 million in stock, notably to hotels, 33 separate transactions. So the big question that remains for a lot of his constituents is, what did he know and when? So he was getting these private briefings. He does get briefings because he's the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So what do we know about what Burr knew and how this may have informed those decisions?
Well, and it's a really good question. We don't exactly know what the contents of those briefings were because they were classified. But we do know that at that point he would have been getting pretty regular briefings about what was going on with the coronavirus, the COVID-19 epidemic worldwide, and what was expected within the United States. So in a very short window of time, as he's getting these warnings and these briefings, he sold somewhere between $680,000 and $1.7 million in stock. And the reason, just to take a quick pause for that wide discrepancy, is because of disclosure requirements in the U.S. Senate. We just don't know exactly if it was $700,000 or if it was $1.69 million. It's unclear. It was somewhere within that range. We do know, based on the reporting of ProPublica, that included in that stock dump was $150,000 of Marriott stock. So there was a significant move that was made to protect himself and protect his assets. Now, you know, he has since issued a statement. He has not done any media. He has not done any interviews, at least that I'm aware of. He released a statement on Friday in which he said, in part, I relied solely on public news reports to guide my decision regarding the sale of stocks on February 13th. Specifically, I closely followed CNBC's daily health and science reporting out of its Asia bureaus at the time, period. I won't read the rest of the statement, but it's important to note that his messaging there is he is saying, I relied what was out there in the public, because if Burr sold based on confidential or classified briefings, and that can be proven, that would rise to the level of a crime.
Right. Well, and that's kind of the interesting question at the center of this. It is illegal for members of Congress to trade shares on non-public information, but it's hard to prove what information he was using to make these decisions. So what are the potential legal implications of these actions?
So as part of that statement that I just read, the back half of the statement, Burr indicated that he had spoken on Friday morning with the chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee and asked him to open a review of what has transpired here. And the Senate Ethics Committee is made up of six members of the United States Senate, three Republicans and three Democrats. I've posed a series of questions to a couple of different folks, and I don't have full clarity on it yet in terms of what is the timeline for that review. Obviously, we're in an unprecedented time here, so orders and meetings and review might not take place as they normally might. But it's my understanding that the Senate Ethics Committee could move to kind of dismiss this issue. They could move to censure Senator Burr. It could go then to the whole Senate, the entire Senate. But that's more of the parliamentary side of this. The other side of this is whether or not there would be some sort of investigation by law enforcement, by the Department of Justice or the SEC to determine if, in fact, these sales were made on the impetus of inside classified information.
So there are also three other U.S. senators who have come under fire for similar stock sales. So put Burr in context and tell us a bit more about who else is being considered as potentially ethics, making an ethics violation.
Yeah. And so the three other senators are Kelly Loeffler of Georgia. She's a Republican. She was recently appointed to fill a vacancy from Georgia. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, also a Republican, and then Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. And they've each offered different kinds of denials. Loeffler has said this has been a baseless attack. It's worth noting that Loeffler's husband is the head of the New York Stock Exchange, which isn't, there's nothing illegal about that, but, you know, it lends itself to kind of some different and unusual optics, if you will. Inhofe, interestingly, said in an interview yesterday, this is the senator from Oklahoma, that more than a year ago, when he received some prominent committee posts, chairman posts in the U.S. Senate, he asked financial advisors to sell off stocks, all of his stocks, so that there wasn't going to be any perceived conflicts of interest. But it was unclear why he was still holding 40% of the stocks that he held more than a year ago. And then Feinstein of California says that the stock dumping or the stock sales that took place were not done by her. It was done in a blind trust, and it was in conjunction with her husband, and she has no control over how her husband handles her finances. But to just back up briefly, you mentioned insider trading and insider trading being banned for members of the of Congress based on confidential or classified information. And I think it's interesting and almost it's crazy to note, but there was nothing barring that until 2012. There was an act passed 8 years ago that barred that. And interestingly, Senator Richard Burr voted against that bill and voted against restrictions for insider trading for members of the U.S. Senate at that time.
Yeah. So, Jeff, this is a time when a lot of people want leadership. We want to know that our leaders are taking everything seriously, are, you know, making moves to get us into a better place. That's kind of why a big part of people are so concerned about Burr's actions. We don't have much time left, but I'd love to zero in on what's happening in North Carolina. How are state lawmakers responding to the coronavirus, and what kind of confidence do we have in how they're handling it from both sides of the aisle?
You know, I would say big picture, I've heard a lot from Republicans and Democrats who have been pleased with how this whole saga, this pandemic, is being handled at the state level, particularly as you juxtapose it to the federal government. There are not name calling. There's not finger pointing and snickering going on here. It seems to be somewhat unified between Republican legislative leaders and the Democratic governor. And that's not something we've seen, as a reminder to listeners, in recent years. There's been a lot of infighting. So the fact that they've come together, at least for the time being, I would say is certainly encouraging. As for specifics that are going to happen here at the state level, lawmakers are still scheduled to come back April 28th. I think that certainly could be pushed to a later time. They're going to have to do a number of things. They're going to have to figure out what happens from the federal level and the details of that. Is there matching money? Are there things that the state has to do in order to open up some of the coffers of what the Congress is doing? So we'll wait to see some of the details of what Congress is doing. And then there are other things that are going to have to be done. For example, one specific example is the tax deadline for the state has been pushed back until July 15th. The governor has the power to do that, but the governor doesn't have the power to waive interest on late taxes. So that's probably not something that would affect you or I that greatly. But for businesses that are making hundreds of thousands or millions upon millions of dollars in revenue, delaying that interest is going to be really important. And that's something I expect the legislature to do when it does come back.
All right. We'll check back in with you soon. Jeff Tiberi is WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
This is my rifle.
The coronavirus has certainly affected people's buying habits. Of course, you probably know the toilet paper and bread are in high demand. So are guns. Federal background check statistics for March are not available, but gun shop owners across the country are reporting a surge in business. Count Larry Hyatt among them. He owns Hyatt Guns in West Charlotte and says he's never seen demand so high. I spoke with him yesterday.
Starting March 13th, Friday the 13th, up until yesterday at closing, it was the busiest the store has ever been. I think they don't like us to give numbers out, but I would say in a typical day this time of year versus what we actually sold, I would say approximately the number of firearms sold was probably 8 to 9 times more than a typical day. And it would have been more, but there's just a physical limit to what you can do.
You actually had to turn people away at the door.
Yeah, well, mainly they turned themselves away. They didn't want to wait in line. They just didn't want to wait in a long line.
How long were the lines?
We had up to 60 people at one time.
So it was going out the door?
Oh, yes. It was down in the parking lot. And it had to be 6 foot apart.
I mean, clearly this is centered around the coronavirus epidemic, but what do you think is really driving these sales?
Well, there's several things. Number one, the virus. Number two, the financial collapse going with it. Number three is what's going to happen to the drug stores and the food stores. Is there going to be enough food? People are wondering if a government can't control drugs and gangs in good times, what are they going to do if things break down? So we saw sort of a fear element of protect the nest. How do I protect my home and my family? And the biggest change, and I've been here over 50 years myself, the biggest change I saw was the number of women buying firearms and trying to buy them to protect their families.
How many women did you see? I mean, what was sort of the percentage?
Normally it's about 10%. Now we saw 30%.
Huh.
And these are urban residents, people who live in the city. They're not gun people. And in fact, a lot of them don't even want a gun or like guns, but they felt they need self-protection.
And that's what they were saying to you then?
Yes. The next group was senior citizens. And they were worried too because, you know, the men were worried, how can I protect myself and my wife? I can't run. I can't fight. So more frail, very worried. And plus, I think they felt like they were more likely to be victims of the virus. But how do you protect yourself if our institutions fail? If you call 911 and nobody comes.
And you are open now because you are deemed an essential business. So what is business looking like at this point for you?
At this point, it's much quieter because we're only working by appointment because we don't have as much staff. About a third of our staff are senior citizens, and we decided they need to be home quarantine, and then we had a few that just didn't feel comfortable. They had sick parents that lived with them, or other people that they didn't want to give it to. So our staff is so reduced that we're doing the appointments now. So the people who purchased a gun and waiting on their background checks, we're calling them once they're approved, they can come and pick up their firearm. We're doing some repairs as well. Some of our law enforcement is still open, but much reduced starting today.
That's Larry Hyatt with Hyatt Guns. Thank you, Mr. Hyatt.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 28, 2020, so I have been told. We are right at Dr. Welsing's birthday. I have to double check to get the exact date, but it is very close. Speaking of grandsisters, unless I am mistaken, since this past Sunday, that's March 22nd, since this past Sunday, we lost Dr. Layla Africa, author, scholar, former guest on The Cows, 2011 in the archives. Credo Mutwa, author, scholar. Never was able to get him on the program, but I know a lot of listeners are fans of Mr. Mutwa's work. Reverend Joseph Laurie, that was pretty more recent, was announced. They have a whole street named after him in Atlanta. I used to trek up and down all the time. Worked with Dr. King. They had lots of tributes today. Will probably be more forthcoming. Floyd Mayweather Jr.'s uncle and trainer, Roger Mayweather. All within the last 7 days. I think I'm even forgetting one. North Carolina Representative Marianne Black. All within the last 7 days. And I don't have any information that any of these folks passed away related to the coronavirus, COVID-19. No information of that. You know, people die for lots of different reasons. But just within the last 7 days. Wow. 2020 has been a spectacularly unpleasant year thus far. Almost every day of it. Enormous losses with the pandemic going on, just losses and losses and losses. But thought that was important to recognize. Grandsisters, remembering each of those victims of racism and many others who have passed with what's happening on the planet right now. What a time. This is our compensatory, weekly compensatory call-in. If you have questions, observations, suggestions, feel free to dial in at the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many, many things to share, given the things that are happening on the planet. The last report where they were talking about the eruption of gun sales, the gang is the system of white supremacy, racist man, racist woman, racist child, you can abbreviate all that, the white race collectively, that is the gang on the planet. Now listen to that segment, and I said, wow. They asked, what do you think is motivating all these white people to come in here and buy guns? I'm inserting white generally, when I generally Every time I've seen a report dating back to when President Obama was elected in 2008, when they show a surge in gun sales, every time it's been white people. I've never seen this type of report air, and then they pan in, and it's people that look like Dr. Welsing and Dick Gregory are running into the firearm store. But I've never seen that report. Every time, it's filled with white people, every single time. Anyway, so they're giving that report, and they say, well, what do you think is motivating people to buy these guns? He said, well, number one, Corona. I have not heard Dr. Fauci, President Trump, no one. When they have talked about what to do, CDC representatives, I have not heard anyone say, hey, you better get a firearm if you want to be safe. I heard them say, wash your hands. Bar of soap. That's what I heard. Firearm, toilet. That's two I haven't made sense of. Firearm, toilet paper. Why are people around the world buy, well, I can't say around the world for the firearms, but the toilet paper. Why are those two things? Like, I have not heard anything about diarrhea. I have not heard anything about a toilet paper shortage. The firearm, miffed on that one completely. So, okay, you can't shoot the virus. I don't know how that's going to keep you safe. Wash your hands. Put the gun down. Wash your hands. All right, so next they said now, collapse of infrastructure, right? They're brawling over toilet paper, what I just said. Like, they won't be able to keep us safe. Get a firearm. I'm in gun-toting Washington State. They have, I told you, they got those bumper stickers. I don't know if these are ubiquitous, but here they got the bumper stickers. Starbucks was founded here, Seattle, Washington, so they have bumper stickers. Coffee and guns, and it's got the like Starbucks logo thing, but in one hand it's got the latte and the other hand it's got the Glock, you know, the special, the 25 or whatever it is, 22, whichever gun. Think of your handgun. Bang, and my coffee, caffeine, and my firearm, ready to roll, take over the world. But those are ubiquitous. You see those with the soccer moms and all over the place. This is gun country. They already got their guns. It would be the same thing with the toilet paper. Going to buy toilet paper, I already got 100 rolls at home. Already got a Costco membership. Already got, you know, my firearm membership, been shooting since I was 12. We've been going out shooting with my grandfather. Already got 5 guns at home. Already got 10 guns at home, but I'm going to get another. That's a lot of what this is. Anytime, system of racism, white supremacy, when I hear white people talking about going to get a gun, the grandsister, Dr. Welsing, she said the great equalizer. All of this motivated by fear, the fear, white genetic annihilation. An environment where you have that type of rapid. I haven't heard, he said he'd never seen. I'm going to assume, that was one question I'd like to ask. I would have compared. So this is a greater gun surge than when President Obama was in office and you had all those whites running around talking about he was going to take our guns? Really? More guns than then? Wow. If you got that many white people who are stressed, out of work, at home, caffeinated, now they got all these extra guns and ammunition. Wow. Extremely dangerous time worldwide on the plantation. Thought exercise. I've said his name a few times. We heard the clip on Obamacare. They had the clip last week. I think it was 10 years or maybe even longer than that since President Obama gave his more perfect union speech on race when he was still a senator and was on the campaign trail. Heard that last week on the compensatory call-in. Has anyone like seriously thought what this would be like if President Obama was still in the White House? So he was having to deal with the Corona response. Whew. Now, I just said, I don't know if folks recall all of the rumors, lies, I think would be more accurate, that he's coming for our guns. Alex Jones and them, remember? He's coming for our guns. He's going to take our guns. Can you imagine him having to be the one to come out and say that we are seriously considering quarantining the East Coast? Are you serious? Whew. I thought about that a few times this week, like, wow, he had a historic number of death threats. Let President Obama have to be the one to come out and say, we might have to consider locking down the border. Might have to consider setting. Whew.
white people in South Carolina are protesting. I was going to read that clip, too. It was at the top of the page. I shifted down because of the funeral for Representative Marianne Black. But they had they got white people, white men in South Carolina who have filed suits about the shelter in place order. You don't have the authority to tell me, a white man, that I can't come out of my shop. I think it was a white gun owner who filed a suit and said, I'm not going to shut my business. You just heard, business is booming. I'm not shutting down business. I'm not at risk. Get out of here. And then it was other just common folks who said, no, I'm not doing this. I'm going to work. You can tell old people to sit at home, people that have a compromised immune system. But I'm a healthy white man. I'm a healthy white woman. And I'm not staying cooped up in the house. Imagine President Obama having to be the one to tell these white people, oh, no, you got to stay in the house. Thought exercise. Next, one of the more disturbing reports that I saw this week, and there were a plethora of them worldwide. The Times-Picayune, we did signature work on Hurricane Katrina, which was mentioned. They said they were talking about different pamphlets mentioned in the audio clips. The Times-Picayune, New Orleans newspaper, their lead newspaper. They have an article, Orleans Parish has highest per capita coronavirus death rate of American counties by far. This was published 2 days ago. I'm going to give it to you and stop at the point where I really, you know, wow, was stymied. Orleans Parish has the highest per capita death rate for the coronavirus among all American counties to date, a new analysis by the Times-Picayune. More disturbingly, perhaps it's not even a close call. The county with the number two rate, Richmond County, New York, better known as Staten Island, has a rate half that of New Orleans. Jefferson Parish, meanwhile, right next door, had the sixth highest per capita death rate among American counties. By Thursday, 46 New Orleanians had died from the virus, or a little more than one out of every 10,000 residents. In Jefferson Parish, which has recorded 12 deaths, the rate was about one for every 36,000 residents. Viewed another way, New Orleans has recorded more deaths than Manhattan, generally seen as America's epicenter of the pandemic, with a population less than a quarter as large. The advocacy organization Together Louisiana has been sounding the alarm about New Orleans' death rates for several days. Epidemiologists and other experts called the numbers very worrisome, but said it's way too early to understand precisely what they prove. They offered several theories, none of them particularly encouraging. One possibility, the virus has been around longer and thus spread more widely within the city and its environs than was initially understood. There's a growing consensus that the virus was on the move by Mardi Gras, which landed on February 25th, though the city would not record its first known case until 13 days later. Deaths lag known infections as an indicator of coronavirus spread, so a surprising number of deaths here could simply indicate an earlier arrival and a broader spread. However, experts also noted the first death attributed to COVID-19 did not occur until March 14. That doesn't undercut the idea that the virus was present by Mardi Gras, but it doesn't necessarily suggest it was here for long before then. It's also possible that some pre-March 14 deaths that were attributable to COVID-19 were simply tallied as deaths from pneumonia. I think we have a huge number of undiagnosed people, said Suzanne Strafe-Bourgeois, a professor at LSU Health Sciences School of Public Health and an expert on pandemics. Expert. Our model shows it started around Mardi Gras and spread, and we only tested people sick enough to be hospitalized, which means most people were not diagnosed because they might have mild signs and symptoms or be asymptomatic and be contributing to the transmission. One factor that is almost certainly a contributor, here we go. New Orleanians, on balance, are less healthy than other Americans, with high rates of diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and other health conditions that can make one more apt to die from coronavirus. Now, actually, let me keep going because they mentioned what I say, the best plantation in the world. Let's see it. The data center on Thursday published a report comparing the rates at which New Orleanians suffer from some of these conditions to those in some of other communities hardest hit by the coronavirus so far. Some of the differences are stark. For instance, 13% of New Orleanians are diabetic compared to 6% of those in King County, where Seattle is, which includes Seattle and which was the nation's first hotspot for the virus. Likewise, 39% of New Orleanians have high blood pressure compared to 28% of New Yorkers. Eating bad food, racism, white supremacy, things that are going to tear down your body, cause you a lot of stress, make you more vulnerable for this? Wow. Super important. That was the first time that I saw that yesterday. Now, again, you can think about that with the fast food, because that's one thing that I can say has been happening here in Seattle. They have been all about health stuff, like going to the store and all of the ginger is sold out. All of the fresh turmeric root is sold out. All about health, 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 taking care, eating quality foods that you can stay healthy through all of this. That's what they have been big about here in Seattle. Not let me get every, you know, piece of greasy fried food and all the rest of it that's going to kill you. More Cheetos. They have had a lot of potato chip runs here in Seattle, too. But generally, lots of healthy eating. Whole Reason, Fitty Cows, Counter Racist Yoga Retreats. Healthy eating, plant-based meals. Looking forward to being in Toronto in May, Washington, D.C. for August. All of that super disrupted. Have no idea if we'll be able to proceed as planned. Certainly want to be responsible in moving forward. And certainly in light of what I just read from the Times-Picayune, anything that is endorsing constructive healthy eating to take care of your body that can bolster your immune system. Exercising is supposed to do that as well. Supposed to be doing yoga every day. Maybe we should be doing that, but we'll have to see. At this point, I'm just taking the pause, wait 30 days and evaluate. Things are advancing so rapidly. They're talking about quarantining New York State, Connecticut, and New Jersey. So just have to see if we'll have to cancel or if we'll be able to proceed. I'm hoping for the latter. Like I said, that Times-Picayune article was stark. Grab for healthier eats. Take care of your body while we are self-quarantined or sheltering in place. Hopefully we are eating quality foods, not doing DoorDash and Grubhub just to eat, you know. What did I see? I went to the grocery store this week. I took a picture on my phone at Wendy's. They got the Baconator. That was next to the sign where they said, the dining room is closed, but feel free. Grubhub, DoorDash, Baconator, right at your door. Baconator. Hopper, let me read that again. One factor that is almost certainly a contributor, the Baconator. New Orleanians on balance are less healthy than other Americans, with high rates of diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and other health conditions that can make one more apt to die from coronavirus, the Chinese disease. Other reports, speaking of, I'll save that one when we get to the thing. If we have folks who have information about schools, I played the report about Seattle, how they're dealing with the school situation. I think schools here are supposed to be closed for about a month. Then they're supposed to open back up sometime after the middle of April. But they're going to proceed with online learning. And they were talking about some of the problems with that. And do the students have devices, mobile devices to work with in their houses? Do they have Wi-Fi and, you know, all the rest of it? That, I think, is huge. I cannot imagine being a student in school right now. College, high school, any of it, really. I cannot imagine if I was a senior in high school, like whoa. Like, not, I was pretty curmudgeonly even in high school, but I cannot imagine like being a senior and all the goofy stuff that you're supposed to do and the prom is supposed to happen and all the rest of it. And man, all that, you might not get to walk across the state. Like, all of that might be totally, you know, sorry, social distancing, can't do any of that. No high fives, not going to get to run across the stage. Like, wow, that, yeah. Devastating times. But yeah, if we have folks, either parents, students, to comment, I've reached out to Azor Savage. He is a student here in Seattle, senior here in Seattle, was a guest on the program a few weeks back to see if we can get a report. Because, I mean, that is amazing, too, how all that's being navigated. And I am sure black students, non-white students, are not going to get the same type of assistance, resources. They already talk about structural things. If you are in an area, residential area, with a lot of black people, a lot of non-white people, you're certainly not going to have super efficient high-speed Wi-Fi, most likely. Might be that you don't have a lot of Wi-Fi devices, even phone, maybe, that sort of thing. Lots of difficulties for non-white children and all this. I could see that happening easily, as by design, in the system of racism. Let's see. The report on Chinese people being attacked. I'm joining that with my weekly request about words. Words, we should make an effort to be precise. That has been reported frequently throughout this pandemic. Precision with words. What are the warnings? What are the symptoms? Is it a shelter in place? Is this a mandatory lockdown? Precision with words. Be accurate. Make sure that there's no confusion with what's being said, using the most accurate terms to describe what we're talking about and not using a lot of sloppy metaphors. When they were talking in that segment about, you know, so-called Asian Americans being attacked, spit on, coughed on, called names, the rest of it, they said they classified these as microaggressions. The term we heard last week, xenophobia, prejudice. Under these conditions, let me go back to the North Carolina site because they had so much information just on the one page. So directly beneath the white people in South Carolina saying, oh, no, you're not going to make us stay in the house. I'm coming out. I'm fine. You're not going to tell me what to do. So beneath that, it's, and you can read it, South Carolina cities, sometimes it's individual people and owners, sometimes it's entire cities. South Carolina cities defy state on restrictions as virus cases rise. Don't they always lead the way in impudence, South Carolina? Dylan Roof. So then we got Representative Marianne Black. She passed away. Okay. So we go then. Man arrested, accused of coughing on fellow store customer. That was what I was looking at when I heard that about, they said, so-called Asian Americans, people are coughing on them and the rest of it. I said, whoa. That is a crime under these conditions. Coughing on bioterrorism. That's what they said about my man, Rudy Gobert. Remember 2 weeks ago, the jazz player, he's a non-white male. He went and touched all the microphones. He was making light, not taking this seriously. He went and was touching all the microphones from the reporters. And then the very next day he came out and, oh man, I got a teaspoon of the Rona. Oh man, right. They announced the thing. They were coming out and said, Rudy Gobert is a bioterrorist. I said something about that last week. They said he should be arrested. That is bioterrorism. He came out and touched all those people's property. Going up and coughing on Asian people. That is white terrorism, not microaggression, minimizing, not prejudice, not bias, not xenophobia. That is criminal activity. I said we got one gang on the planet. Didn't they read that report last week? White supremacist sites, they were saying, oh, man, if you get the Rona, you are duty bound. You got to go out and spread it to as many of those coons as possible. Didn't folks read that report last week? Words are important. If we could refrain from using metaphors, analogies, comparisons, use accurate words to describe what it is we intend to say. racist white supremacists as a part of their business. They use metaphors deliberately to spread confusion, microaggressions. Victims, we have been exposed to this misconduct for a long time, and many of us, myself included, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't quite have logic to articulate our views, and so in its place we'll substitute an analogy, a comparison, a metaphor of some sort. If we could make an effort to be exact, precise with what it is we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, questions, observations, that would be grand, just to make sure everyone gets one opportunity to speak. If you have additional questions or suggestions, if you could let everybody get their one turn and then you can add your additional thoughts or observations, that would be grand. Also, if you could make sure you're not in a noisy environment, although I don't know that would be right now. Most of us should be at home, so it shouldn't be too rowdy in your house. If it is, if you could move to a quieter area and then use your mute button so you can speak, share your views, and then when you're done, hit mute. That way we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary disruptions in the background. Much obliged. Thank you kindly. Number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Forgot we will be here Monday. We have been on the counter-racist grind, even under quarantine, and with white guests, no less. We will have white guests, might be plural, on Monday. There was a report written before the Rona took over everything. There was a report written about the plague, white supremacy, racism, and specifically white children, racist child. There was a report authored for educators that are teaching to middle school, high school, racist children and what to do about them. This reporter was about how to try to neutralize that and maybe see if we can interrupt that process. The authors of that report, white women educators, will be on the program this coming Monday. Normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Not going to let the virus slow down the counter-racist grind. With that, we will hit the phone lines. First, we folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts, particularly, like I said, parents, how this is impacting your child's education or the child wants to speak directly. Great. That would be awesome. As I said, thought exercise. If folks have an opinion, an idea how all of this would be going if Barack Hussein Obama was still hanging out at the White House and he had to preside over all of this, how do we think that would be going? First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, good evening. Mortgage banker from VA. Hope everybody's staying safe. Social distancing, all that good stuff. Couple of things, yes. I do have offspring. It's been an adjustment. Two teenagers, one home from college, one in high school. Both have been adjusting pretty well. They have online curriculums. I think the good thing, not a, I don't want to say it's a good thing, but obviously I live in a majority white neighborhood, so the white people around here are extremely serious about education. So they have really kept the online learning and online distance learning up to date. I have also instituted a couple of additional lessons. We've been talking about money a lot and why it's good to go lean. Make sure you have all your debts down and, you know, people are not blowing up your phone to collect money because they still will be. So that's one reason why I think what Mr. Fuller talks about, which is only get what you need. Try to be as resourceful as possible. I also wanted to share a couple of things, if you wouldn't mind, about just the mortgage business and how this is going to affect black families. And then we interviewed on another broadcast today that I do locally in Charlottesville area, a black doctor. So I'll be real quick. What a lot of mortgage companies are going to go out there and see is they're going to be offering forbearances And basically what that means is that you don't have to make mortgage payments, obviously, because a lot of people are going to be affected through this by their employment not working. The issue on how that affects the financial markets is that, you know, if you guys own a company, and let's just call it ABC Company, imagine for 90 days somebody not buying your product. That's essentially what happens when mortgage companies are telling consumers that they don't have to make mortgage payments. So you're going to have millions of people all across the U.S. that are not making mortgage payments. Servicers who collect those mortgage payments are actually hedging that money, and they're actually lending it out. So it totally crashes the financial markets, and you're going to continue to see volatility. So if you currently are a homeowner, you might want to take advantage of it to save a little cash if necessary. But if you're in the mortgage process, you know, expect that things might get a little bit hairy. Guidelines might get a little bit, they might change, particularly with low credit borrowers and black borrowers. If you're on the low credit scale, it's definitely going to affect you. We spoke to a black doctor here in the Charlottesville area, very constructive material. She specifically spoke about the failings of number 45. That's what they want to call him. Not being prepared, how they even globally, she has colleagues globally that were talking. She was talking to other doctors and saying how they were prepared for this thing. Pandemic months ago, they were doing tests. She even said that they had a test at Gus's alma mater. That's where she works, UVA. The test that they were giving to people was taking like 8 or 9 days to come back. And literally, it was making the patients gag, and sometimes those patients were throwing up or spitting at the doctors or the nurses that were giving them the test, so they weren't even protected properly. But she gave a lot of information. She stated that the U.S. numbers up here are going to be anywhere between, she said deaths anywhere between 200,000 to a million. So black people really need to take this really, really seriously. Obviously, when the United States or globally, you know, if anything happens globally, you know, if it's bad, black people end up getting a super high. It just affects us in a really, really bad way. So, you know, hope everybody's staying safe out there. Hope I provide some good constructive information, and I'll mute my line and maybe talk a little bit later. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, sir. University of Virginia, the Coon Man's alma mater as well. The great governor of the Commonwealth, Ralph Northam, going to get hairy. That is a metaphor. That's an important one too, because for financial advice, you definitely like, or I like, specifics. But hairy, I think people grasp. I'd have even left to look in the word guide for that one to see is that one that we should be recommending not to use. Like, I'll ponder on that as I scratch my beard. I will ponder on the use of the word hairy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts, observations, questions, thank you for the excellent suggestion, sir. Other folks who dialed in?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, to all the callers and the listeners. This is a black female from New York, now living in South Carolina. Just to give you a little bit of insight on what you spoke of regarding white men protesting a stay-at-home order here in South Carolina. South Carolina, as we know, is one of the poorest states as far as revenue is concerned in the country. The governor has been virtually silent on this coronavirus epidemic. The reason is because South Carolina has a centralized health department called DHEC, which stands for the Department of Human. Anyway, it's the health service department here, and it controls all of South Carolina. In addition to that, the mayor of Columbia, South Carolina, which is considered the capital of South Carolina, not Charleston, Columbia, is a black man. and he initiated this stay-at-home order, which is only for the city of Columbia. Columbia consists of a lot of counties and a city, much like New York consists of boroughs, which are considered their own individual counties. The Bronx is a county, Manhattan is a county, Queens is a county. So here you have Columbia, which is the city. Then you have Richland County. You have Kershaw County. You have Casey, which is another city. So essentially, when this black man put down this stay-at-home order, everyone went crazy. Now, he was as lenient as possible because I'm going to tell you, he's even got dry cleaning services down there as an essential service. Basically, nothing, in my opinion, by looking at this order, nothing changes. But in my opinion also, because he's a black man, all the other counties went crazy. They were like, oh, no, we're not staying home. But let me also just give you a fact about how critical this is here in South Carolina. According to DHEC, this was 6 hours ago, there are 121 new cases of coronavirus in South Carolina, two new deaths, and 1,500 samples of testing samples backlogged. The reason for that is, again, there is a centralized system, but they're doing two tests in South Carolina. Because they wanted to make money, they have private companies testing, and they have DHEC, the oversight health for the state of South Carolina testing as well. However, only the DHEC cases have to be reported. So there essentially are hundreds and hundreds of more cases here, in my opinion, in South Carolina that are not being reported because the private companies don't have to report them. But somebody is making money off of that. So that's a little bit of insight into what's going on here in South Carolina. As far as the schools are concerned, they extended this, their closing until April 30th. I don't foresee them going back anytime soon. I think the school year is a wrap. Everybody's going to pass. My clients who are teachers told me that they've been instructed to just pick up where they left off back in this month when the schools were initially closed. And, you know, and just try to wing it from there. So that's all I had to say. I just hope that, Dr. Welding's birthday was March 18th. And we lost also Manu Dibango, who is the African saxophonist and a musician who made one of our favorite anthems, Soul Makusa. All right? So that's all I had to say. Thank you, Gus, for letting me share. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly. I would say I don't know how you feel about your move, but wow. If any time in history it would be better to be in South Carolina as opposed to New York, this is it, unless I have been misinformed. Wow. Other folks who are with us, if you have comments to share, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, I did want to get in really quick. The DHEC chief of staff, Rick Toomey, T-O-O-M-E-Y, suspected white man, suspected racist, he took a leave of absence this week, like yesterday. He just stepped down in the middle of all this to take a leave of absence. Like, wow, abdicating responsibility. You can check that out on your own. Rick Toomey, T-O-O-M-E-Y. Other folks who dialed in with commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to just share a couple of things. I was watching the news and they were speaking about, what's happening in different cities and the increased positive tests that come back for coronavirus. And one of the things they mentioned about the Northeast, the United States, was that Rhode Island is now, Rhode Island now has a state trooper stationed at, state troopers and National Guard stationed at different bridges and what have you. I don't know if there was a segment. I missed the segment. But there's an article in the New York Times that also talks about it too, where they're stopping New Yorkers to stop the spread. And it reminded me of, the Edmund Pettus Bridge and how they were stopping New Orleanians from going over to different counties or parishes or cities, whatever, what have you, during Hurricane Katrina. So I just thought that that was interesting. Like, it's not technically, it seems like you cannot technically stop somebody from moving about the United States, at least at this point, but I don't know if this is a slow start to things to come. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the repercussions was like a fine, and then if you keep doing it, then it'll be jail time or something like that. I guess I'll just leave it there for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. Just striving for accuracy, you are conflating your bridges, bridge moments of white supremacy. So got a case of the Rona there. The Edmund Pettus Bridge is in Alabama. That is the site of Bloody Sunday, where, again, mute button, no need to have people coughing in the background and such. Yes. The Edmund Pettus Bridge is in Alabama, and that is where black people were beaten on a Sunday. I believe that was in March. That was the movie Selma, Alabama, Edmund Pettus Bridge, Ava DuVernay's project. And I believe that bridge is even, I would totally mute the person, but my switchboard, like I just asked about that, mute your line. There's no need to have echoing and such in the background. Mute your line, please. Much obliged. The Edmund Pettus Bridge is in Selma, Ava DuVernay's project. The Katrina situation, another mention for Katrina, that was the Crescent City Bridge, where the refugees, looters, were trying to flee for their lives, and they were stopped on the Crescent City Bridge from being able to exit the town. That was the beginning of Katrina after the flood. But that's the Crescent City Bridge in Louisiana. The Edmund Pettus Bridge is in Alabama. Two different moments on bridges in the history of white supremacy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
I just want to say thank you for the correction. My apologies. I'll meet online.
No worries. Other folks who dialed in, do you have commentary? While folks are spectating, to get to the other folks on the line, my switchboard is misbehaving as well, so it might take me a moment to see if I can get that to behave again so that I can get to the other folks who have a hand up. I'll give out the number while I'm waiting for that to behave, work correctly. The number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Ooh-wee, I got my switchboard back. Yes, indeed. Thank you. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Evening, Gus. Greetings to the family. The Parks Department came around, took down basketball hoops, swings, tennis nets, soccer nets, Mexicans. They saw one day people was in the park playing ball and
I guess they said, okay, we're gonna make these Negroes social distance, take down the nets, take down the hoops, you know. So still didn't change anything. Yesterday, they definitely were not following the mandate. So I saw everyone in their, you know, in that metaphor, you know, I saw everyone. I haven't seen in a while. It was 60 degrees in New York, and, you know, everybody came outside. And what can you say? The police didn't stop anything, or, you know, stores stayed open later yesterday because they were making money, and, you know, nothing was done. Kids home from school throughout the city, supposed to be homeschooling, but unfortunately, kids are poor and non-white, so they have issues with the homeschooling here. You got a city with almost 5 million white people, and 80% of the public school is non-white. How did that happen? But no computers, no laptops, no tablets, no Wi-Fi. Parents owe outstanding cable bills, so the deal with the cable company for them to get a free router via the school doesn't go through, you know, because the cable system has them its own money. And then so that money is paid, they can't get any more equipment. So that's putting a lot of these children in limbo from getting the proper education they need. Not counting the over 100,000 students living in shelters who don't have access to a lot of these things. Some of the shelters don't allow cable to come into them at all. So you also have tens of thousands of kids in foster care, and this could potentially cause a problem, especially if, you know, they have to be home and the person taking care of them has to work when they do allow us to work again. 56 people were infected in the shelters as of yesterday, and they were talking about shutting down the shelters. What I have noticed is in the trains, you see a lot more homeless people riding around. So I think this all could be a result of lack of people on the train. Also, you know, them quarantining some of the shelters one at a time and things like that. So just a terrible situation. Time magazine featured an article with a woman who was billed $34,927.43 after being tested and treated for coronavirus. Now, of course, we all heard Trump say the government was going to be paying for the treatment of the coronavirus. So this just gave me a glimpse at how profitable coronavirus is going to be for the medical industry. If I was a doctor or a hospital administrator, if you come into my hospital or to my doctor's office with a common cold, flu, or bronchitis, guess what my diagnosis for you is going to be? You know, I'm going to get my bump up. This could get bad. I'm getting a lot of white backlash to the tri-state quarantine from the rest of the United States, white people. Black people, average black person in New York, if you ask them if they've been outside of New York, they'd be like, I've been in New Jersey once or twice. So that's, you know, that's how it is here. Like, they, so it's white people that's really restricted from traveling, and they're not taking this very lightly. I'm waiting for talks of secession. New York is seceding from the Union. But, you know, even Bloomberg magazine reported that, in Rhode Island police to hunt down New Yorkers seeking refuge. I said, wow, New Yorkers are seeking refuge. If they start calling these white people refugees, like Katrina victims, that's, oh man, this might be the greatest thing ever, this quarantine. But man, this is getting ugly, you know, so we'll see what happens. Letting people out of jail, in my opinion, this is a disaster waiting to happen. Where are these people going? They can't legally live in public housing with a felony.
in a lot of places that's not public housing, you know, leases stipulate no one with a felony can live there, get their mama, or girlfriend, or friend, or whoever evicted, automatic eviction if you they find out that a felon's living in those apartments. And it's just so quickly done. It's, you know, what's going to be the, you know, we know how white people do things sometimes, and then the consequences always tend to backfire on us. So, you know, I would be very skeptical. And then, you know, a lot of these people are coming back to, you know, areas where other black people live. And, you know, what's going to happen? There's no job. There's no one to work. So this is just like, you know, this is like, you know, I don't want to say recipe for disaster. I'm trying not to think of a metaphor, but this is going to be bad. System of injustice. And in an unjust system of lawmaking and law enforcement, the system is a system of selective prosecution. So will this these congressmen and women go to jail for cheating the financial system that they were elected to keep? And I'm using this word only because it's what is called a fair market. Taking insider information that only they knew, because who else knew they were going to shut the whole country down and quarantine us other than the Congress and the people there? They also knew that which stocks were going to prosper and which ones were going to drop as a result of their actions. And they go and take their money out. And in 2 weeks, exactly what happened, the stock market fails. And not to mention someone, they sold their stock to someone who had no idea that any of this was going to happen, I'm sure. So, but they're not going to go to jail because we're in a system of injustice, you know, selective prosecution. That's it, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and all the callers and listeners. So I received, like, my heart has, I mean, today I've been feeling sad, mainly for the healthcare workers. I have quite a number of family and really close friends who are nurses, a few from New York, and a cousin of mine. She reported very, very sad news yesterday as far as the COVID patients. She told me before I saw even the president say that they were talking about changing a hospital to an all COVID hospital. She posted that in family chat. But I kind of wanted to give you guys a real look or some true insight on what the medical professionals are dealing with. And I'm going to read something she posted. Really, it's really thorough and good. Now the RNs must wear their N95 masks for 1 week. You will get a brown bag to store your goggles and mask weekly. There will be no more isolation precautions at the hospital, only isolation for coronavirus patients and C. diff. ESBL, K. bacilli, pneumonia, MRSA, E. coli, viral meningitis, pseudomonas, you name the infection, no gown, no mask, nor face shield, should be worn, not by any medical providers at no time. This includes therapists, doctors, nurses from all levels, period. For all positive COVID or pending coronavirus patients, nurses must wear one gown per 12-hour shift. So hang them and reuse. Also, the same gown must be worn from patient to patient by all providers. The weekly mask, the one N95 must be stored in a brown bag in a designated area for reuse each time you're working for 1 week. No personal protective gear should be worn, period, for no patient, even when doing a procedure, except for coronavirus patients. I guess for sterile procedures like a central line insertion or a chest tube, then the pre-packaged kit designated will be used. Staff can buy anything needed for protecting themselves and bring along to work. There are no rules now. You can even show up in Daisy Dukes. No one even cares anymore. It's not about protecting patients anymore. It's life or death to protect yourself. I cried for hours yesterday and know that at some point my tears won't mean a thing. We were told by hospital officials that this is not just Tenet Hospital but that has made these changes, but all hospitals in America will be doing this, if not worldwide. All ICU will now be equipped for coronavirus patients. Think about all the patients that do not have the coronavirus but meet the criteria for ICU. Despite the infection, whether contact or droplet, now will only be separated by 2 feet distance and a thin curtain. I never believed that this would ever happen in my lifetime. God help us all. Worried for my family and worried for my life. And, you know, like I said, I have another dear friend who is there. We messaged today. I was checking on her. I have a brother-in-law who is a respiratory therapist in Oklahoma. They seem to have a lot of PPE kits, so he's trying to get some extras and mail them to New York to these nurses who are without proper PPE. But my friend says that if you saw on the news, they were highlighting a young male nurse who died. She says that's at her sister hospital. So the medical providers that are working themselves are very much on the front lines and are very vulnerable to this disease as well. I saw a Facebook post, and I don't know if anyone else may have seen it, with a nurse who quit because she was forced to work with coronavirus patients after her nurse manager knew that, number one, she had no one to watch her children for her. So therefore, when she went home, she would not be able to isolate herself from them. And number two, she herself had a serious medical history. And the nurse manager told her that she had to work. So, you know, I thought about that Black self-respect. She quit. She was extremely angry, and she made a live video. So although we're talking about the patients and people being upset, but there are some real lives really that are on the line, and we need to keep them in mind and encourage them. If you know anyone, send them a text. If you have any extra equipment, you could send it to them. And I'll mute my line on that.
Thank you for sharing. Wow. That is absolutely Black self-respect. I've seen a number of reports like what you just shared with that Black mother and just saying, wait a minute now. I mean, we all got bills and, you know, need income for things. But I mean, wow, if I die or my child dies, I mean, what is this all for? Like, you know, even if I infect my child, like, man, come on. Like, say that on workplace racism all the time. You have to take your safety. You have to make sure that is a primary concern for you at all times. Is so many different fields worldwide. It's white employees who don't have protective gear and are complaining and doing the same thing that she just talked about, saying we don't have necessary equipment. We don't have PPE and all the rest of it. System of racism, white supremacy. You're a Black person in this environment? Oh, man, they might hand you a garbage bag. Yeah, exactly what she said. No rules. And I have seen posts of that where they had healthcare providers who did have garbage bags because they didn't have any other equipment. So take your safety seriously, whether it's a global pandemic or not. That is something to keep in mind under workplace situations. And you should have in mind there are certain situations and this job is not worth it. My safety, my Black self-respect dictates this is not worth it. All that to say, and I did hear, I think they said in the report, even though a single payer healthcare system, universal healthcare, that would be better. What they got in Canada and other spots, South Korea, that would be better. even though Obamacare, they haven't been able to get rid of it, that at least made it a little bit better. Even though we're obviously not prepared, that was a little bit helpful. But they're still trying to get rid of it. Damn Obama. Other folks that we missed completely, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Hi, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to kind of give a little bit of insight on what's going on, I guess, in my area. So basically what essentially happened is that there's been a bit of contradiction, I guess, with the, you know, the stay-at-home orders. Currently, like, our county judge has basically said that all businesses are essential and that people should continue to report to work. However, on the local or municipal level, there have been mandates put in place where certain, like, places where you eat, bars and breweries, they can only do, you know, people can't come in to actually eat. So a lot of people are, there's a lot of confusion, and it seems basically, I guess, with the current president, basically he's just letting the governors decide, and then once it gets on a local level, there's a lot of contradiction. In terms of, like, my son's schooling, they have extended their spring break. It is kind of creating a bit of difficulty for me. However, they are continuing his online, they've pushed everything to, like, online lessons. Fortunately, the school district that we live in, you know, they're really good about, you know, if you don't have, like, a tablet or you don't have, like, internet capability, they've ensured that, you know, the people have them. And also, for the kids who were, like, lower, I guess maybe more on the lower income, and they depended on school to get breakfast and lunch, they have, the schools are open and people can still drive by and pick up those necessities. For me, the biggest difficulty has been that, you know, I work for local government. My workplace, for the most part, is still open. However, school is not, so it's been difficult for me having to, you know, work and then come home and then go over the, like, the internet lessons with my son. Other than that, the cases are growing in the county that I currently live in, but I don't think it's at such a at the rate of, like, New Orleans or New York City, and that's pretty much going what's going on in my area. And I just had a question for maybe you or the listeners. I think from what I've heard and seen on TV, the CDC, I think they recommend only, like, healthcare providers wear the N95 mask. However, it seems I care about my health and my son's health. So anytime we have to go grocery shopping, we have to be in a public place, you know, we both have one of those particular masks. And I just, maybe you knew or maybe someone else knew, is that, can that, you know, protect you, you know, from, let's say, if someone, you know, sneezes or coughs or any kind of droplet, does it offer that protection? Because CDC seems to be, you know, saying, oh, you know, if you're not sick, you shouldn't wear it. But at the same time, my understanding is that the virus is caught through, like, you know, droplets and you know, those, like, those sorts of particles. So maybe someone can, you know, answer that question and give some sort of insight on that.
Much obliged, ma'am. Thank you kindly. We'll try to nab other folks that we've missed totally, so we can go straight with everybody we missed completely. And then if other people want to respond to that that we've already heard from, they can do so. Folks that have any medical expertise, that would be grand. I know personally, it's been, you said, confusing. And I think other people have said that. It's been contradictory because I have seen reports, and these are healthcare officials, where they have said, oh man, the mask, it doesn't really work that well unless you have one of those really high grade ones, but just the generic ones that people have doesn't really work that well. Sometimes the droplets can get through, and sometimes you can self-contaminate. They were saying that as well when you go to take it off, and you know, it can get on your hands and that sort of thing. So I was seeing some messages that were saying that it wasn't as effective, and then I saw other reports in like the New York Times and places that were saying that it was effective, at least at some degree. So there's been confusion around that from what I've seen. I'm not a medical professional nor qualified to give medical advice. So, yeah, it's been confusing and contradictory. I've seen reports that have said, oh, it's not a big deal or it's not going to help. And then I've seen other reports that say, oh, yes, it will help to some degree. So I personally do not wear a mask, but I do a lot of staying by myself and staying inside. So I'm generally not around anybody, much less anyone sneezing or coughing.
Right, right. And I guess the biggest thing for me is, you know, if they're saying like the medical professionals who, you know, have to deal directly with those patients who have the corona or the COVID-19 virus, you know, if they're wearing the N95, I'm just, you know, just trying to protect myself and, you know, protect my family. And some of the cases that were spread around here, once they start tracking, like, you know, was this due to travel? Or how did this person catch this? And it's community spread. So it makes me believe, like, you know, hey, there are some extra precautions that one can put, you know, in place. And, you know, I guess it's better to be safe than it is to, you know, be sorry. And a lot of people are still, you know, just going out and people, you know, they're coughing. They're not really paying attention to any of those guidelines. But, you know, as you said, I know you're not a medical professional, but, you know, I'm just trying to kind of see if, you know, what we're doing, if that can, you know, help, you know, prevent from catching it whenever you do have to go grocery shopping or, you know, those things that you have to do, because I still have work at this point, so.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. Yeah. Understandable. That's all logical. I can understand that from any parent. I'm sure we have some other parents here too, so they can kind of share some of their, because they have the same worries. You know, they have to go out. They want to protect themselves. They want to protect their offspring and the rest of it. So we'll see if other parents and or folks with medical expertise. I will say Dr. Rassayan, who is both a parent, medical expertise. I spoke with him yesterday. We are trying to see about having him back on the program. He is still working. He is a professor, so he's doing the online teaching and all the rest of it. But he said he should be able to carve time out of his schedule after this coming week. So probably April, it would sound like. But I spoke with him yesterday, and he talked about his routine and what he encourages, tells his children to do when they go out. And I do not recall. I'll have to double check. If we can get him on next April, if we get him on, I'll double check. But I don't recall him saying that he did a mask or told his children about that. His centered a lot around, in fact, I'll see if I can recall all the details. It was gloves. He had specific gloves. He says he would keep a specific pair in the vehicle. So then he goes out, he wears these gloves. I believe he said there was a specific type of isotoner all-season glove. Maybe even have two pairs of those, have one in the car, so he wears those at all time when he's out in public and what have you. When he gets to his and washing your hands all the time, of course, when he gets to his residence, takes off his shoes. I saw that on multiple sites where that was highly recommended, to take your shoes off when you go in the house to keep from spreading germs. Obviously, to encourage other people that you reside with to do the same thing. He said if he's been around other people, he takes all of his clothes off when he enters the residence, or strips, you know, at least the outer clothing. I heard that as well reported a number of different healthcare providers. They said it's not as important, the clothing, if you are by yourself, that's not as big a deal. But if you are around other people and things, then yeah, take your clothes off and then have different clothes that you wear while you're in the house, and house slippers of some sort. And then going to wash your hands, wash your face. He said he did a like nostril rinse and a gargle just to clean up. And most of it centered around the thing that we have been joking around, soap. Just going, and after doing all that, going, wash your hands, washing up, and having the solution, like I said, for his nostrils and that sort of thing. But a lot of it just centered around cleanliness, being clean. I don't recall him saying that he wore a mask when he's in the D.C. area, so he's on the East Coast. I don't remember him saying he had a mask or encouraging his children. Oh, when he said he keeping the nails cut short. A lot of it was just basic rudimentary, keeping the nails cut short so you're not easily picking up germs and debris and things underneath your fingernails when you're going out, which goes right with wash your hands. Other folks who dialed in that we've missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago.
Hey, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The question that you had posed about if Obama was still president during this time, what would it be like? I myself went back saw a video of Obama in 2009 when he was talking about the H1N1. Now, according to the CDC and the World Health Organization, that also was considered a pandemic. Although what they have is a pandemic level one, I think it was listed as. And I remember I was watching his, it was like a 5-minute speech he did where he talked about, you know, things are in place, don't panic, but but take it seriously. And he said the same message, wash your hands, and if you're sick, stay at home, which was so interesting. I mean, he said this over 9-10 years ago. But, you know, I just feel like he'll get the typical reaction that he's always been getting. He'd be called a nigger. Alex Jones would probably, have a video about, him causing this. And so, I wouldn't be surprised if, Obama would be much more attacked racially by white people. And speaking of which, here in Chicago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who is the mayor of Chicago, non-white black woman, also openly gay, she this week shut down the parks and the beaches. Now, what was interesting was apparently she saw, we had a 60-degree day here in Chicago, and apparently she said she saw a bunch of people congregating on the beach and the lakefront, also playing basketball as well. Now, the area that she was referring to was an area where predominantly white people live at. So she had a city order closing all the beaches, basically no congregating, and white people basically went crazy. The one thing I like about Facebook, when you see like the live stream of the mayors and the governors and the president, you get to see the comments, and it was very much a racist attack on Lori Lightfoot. That nigger bitch can't, close our beaches, and all kind of crazy stuff on the timeline. So that was interesting. I've also noticed too that since a lot of people are kind of inside, that looking at the news and looking at, when they report crime, and particularly in two TV stations, local TV stations that I watch here, a lot of the crime is in the white neighborhoods now. And I don't hardly hear anything about, shootings or murders in black in black areas. So, I thought that was pretty interesting. But of course, black people, we don't take this seriously. So, I kind of noticed that as well. Like this kind of reminiscent to what Governor Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, had did a couple of weeks ago when he had to cancel the Irish Day Parade. But then, one of his motivations of the court order or the mandated stay-at-home order was because during St. Patrick's Day weekend, he saw a whole bunch of Irish pubs being, filled to capacity. And, that was kind of interesting how he had to do that stay-at-home order because, black people, wasn't congregating in these pubs. So, you know, we don't take this seriously, right? CPS is doing a remote learning starting on Tuesday, I think it is Tuesday. So it's not technically like e-learning or online learning. It's some sort of remote learning. I don't know if, you know, the children have been sent home with packets or stuff like that, but it's some sort of remote learning. My daughter, who goes to a non-CPS school, she is already doing e-learning online. It's a predominantly white school, so obviously they're going to have the technology and they're going to have all the amenities for for it because of the fact that, you know, white people run the school. So that's all I have right now in my life.
Wow. Poor Mayor Lightfoot. That's why I said, like, man, the Obama family, if I was them, I am glad we will let President Trump deal with this one. Like, wow. It would be like what's happening in South Carolina. I can't even matter. Like, magnified exponentially. What he just mentioned in Chicago. What? Incidentally, the same thing happened in Seattle. Now, I don't, not the cursing out the mayor and racist stuff and all that stuff, but the park, they didn't close all the parks, but the beginning of this week when they gave the shelter in place, they closed a number of parks and beaches for the same reason. They said that and obviously Seattle and Washington State is not overflowing with niggers. But they said the same thing, that it was sort like more of a request, even though a lot of businesses and things had already been shut down here in the Seattle area and abroad before this past Monday. They said that they were going out, they were looking at traffic, and people weren't taking it seriously. They were still going out at the park and playing basketball, which I did see, and going out and playing with their dogs in the park, which I did see in great number. And they're not taking this seriously. So that was when that came down Monday. But yes, I have seen that with my own peepers, and I have heard that in a number of reports. White people having the same sort of response. You're not going to tell us what to do. I'm going to take my dog to the park whenever I feel like it. We're going to the beach whenever I feel like it. Like, yeah, I'm a white woman, I'm a white man, and no nigger mayor is going to tell me I can't go to the beach, or no white man, in fact, is going to tell me I can't go to the beach. That's what they said in South Carolina. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, observations, questions, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, this is caller So you think the Obama administration is going to get free of it? Nope. I'm reading the thing right now. Biden pressed on reports Obama administration failed to replenish respirator masks. So boom, there you go. Obama administration, it's on him. But I just wanted to call to say with the learning and everything, school, my daughter, I got one daughter that's in high school, and she had to come home and, you know, just do the little Wi-Fi. But while the coronavirus is going, everybody's out of school. And they, if you don't have Wi-Fi, they won't get it to you through your ISP. What they did was they turned up the Wi-Fi so when you go, you can park in the parking lot. When you go to your school, park in the parking lot, and then you'll be able to connect and do your homework. So that's the best they could do where I'm at. And I was going to say something else, but I don't know. It escapes me. Maybe it wasn't that important, but thank you for taking my call.
Wee, that is so tacky. My gosh. Like, the best we can offer in a system of white supremacy racism is we'll turn up the Wi-Fi signal at the school. I don't know what part 702 is, but the best we can offer is we'll turn up our Wi-Fi signal at the school and you can come in your, that's not social distancing either. If you have to sit in the car, like presumably it would be the child, at least one parent would have to drive. So we got to drive and sit in the parking lot in the car to do a homework lesson. Now what, Woof, that is so tacky and trifling. My goodness, that's the best we can do. Much obliged, ma'am. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, observations, comments, suggestions, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. About the virus, I wanted to say people get tired of hearing me talk about the chemicals that are dumped in the sky, but most viruses are spread during the cold weather, and during the hot weather, you don't get many of the viruses. That's even why they call it cold. You have a cold because it happens to in the cold environments. The chemicals that are dumped from those specialized airplanes are blocking the sun, making it colder. If they stopped that, the virus probably would cease. We saw this whole global pandemic. The virus is in all the countries that they spray heavy chemtrails. And even with the decrease in airplane flights, that caused the aerosol masking effect to decrease, so there's less particles in the air from the regular airplanes. And so then the temperature has been increasing. And so there's had to be an adjustment in how many airplanes, specialized airplanes, were flown to drop chemical dumpings in the sky. There had to be more of those airplanes. So if you look, while a lot of the other flights are grounded, you'll see more of these specialized airplanes, chemtrail planes. It's related. It's going to continue to be related to the things that are happening on the planet. And then the other thing I was going to mention is the name. So there was the Ebola virus that affected the black people in the area where Igbo people are. There was the West Nile virus. But these viruses are being given a name of black people, and then the virus. And then you also have, the coronavirus affecting white people. But, you know, they get to be related to royalty. And then there's a whole bunch of other things. There's a lot of arrests that are happening at this time. A lot of very famous people being arrested all at the same time. A lot of talks about adrenochrome. A lot of talks about the black children that have been murdered all this time. The many black children that have been murdered all this time. Their blood has been passed around to a lot of the rather important white people. But there's a whole lot of things that are happening aside from just this virus. But even this virus isn't so difficult, possibly not so difficult to stop. Because if we didn't have the chemtrails, people don't like to hear it, but if we didn't have the chemtrails right now, it would be hot enough to where it'd be about late spring weather. So thank you.
Imhan DC. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, I'll give out the number again. We have less than 30 minutes left in the program, so please don't wait till the last minute if we have missed you totally. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 to participate. Folks, we have missed completely.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ari.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, my gosh. New Orleans. Woof. Highest per capita rate. Stay safe.
Yeah. We're fine. We're safe. Limiting the exposure to the outdoors, although part of my report is that a lot of the black-owned businesses are going out of business for good or for the foreseeable time, while white-owned businesses are thriving and are open like nothing has happened. I observed a car wash that was open, bars, pizzerias, mostly bars and a pizzeria next to the bar in an area that would be considered highly populated by white people. But the black-owned businesses are going on social media to let their patrons know, hey, we tried, but we got to close. And I did see a report that the SBA said that they were going to be giving out loans to businesses, but that's not going to be effectual for a lot of the businesses that are owned by non-whites, because statistically, white businesses and stuff that gets those SBA loans. Moving on, Greta Thunberg, whatever her name, I think she's being groomed for some type of political position in the future. And I don't know, I don't want to say it's like just a feeling, but I suspect that I just do that it's going to be something that would be in an official capacity in world government, not just over in Europe. And I say that based on, the trek she took to the United States to speak to the UN. And then conveniently, she was on social media and told people, I had Corona too, I think, but I got over it. I'm like, yeah, how convenient is that? You got Corona, but you're past it. And I don't know, some white showcasing confusion. And I'm coming up with a term myself, because just trying to make it seem like, oh, this white girl cares about the world or whatever. But anyhow, let's see. I have a list. Back to my list. White people are breaking the stay-at-home orders in big ways. The police barricaded the black part of the lakefront of Lake Pontchartrain that we commonly go to, but the side near the white people or by white people were open. The police went down there and were like, hey, y'all need to go home. They're like, yeah, okay, we're going. And then they went right back after they thought the police were gone, and they had to break it up again. And there's some foresight, I do believe, by officials in knowing that Corona would have spread during Mardi Gras. I mean, why wouldn't it? And people are so packed in during that time that if you have a weak immune system, or even if you don't, you're going to carry some type of biological debris back home with you. India is, their cases might go skyrocket past everyone's really soon. From a report on Vice, I was looking at, they're already, unfortunately, the victims of racism, but they don't keep their country up too nicely. And that's on good days. They will get in the Ganges and swim and bathe like it's nothing next to a cow. So they're having really difficult times with keeping things clean and getting people to understand the importance. But at the same time, they said the police are, like, beating whoever comes outside. Like, you could be a doctor on your way to work, and they're beating people and making them do push-ups. Nurses, other caregivers, people that just need to get to and fro. They said there are like thousands of migrant workers that are stuck in the city that are trying to find their way back home to their villages on foot, like men and women with children on their shoulders, walking for hundreds of miles just to get home because there's no more work and they're stuck. Another report on foreign affairs, Syria, their corona cases are going up, and they're dealing with constant onslaught over there. I can't imagine. I just pray for them. The victims of racism over there trying to deal with a sickness while they're literally trying to figure out when they can escape a house that might be getting ready to come down on their heads. And I saw a report, it was on Vice again, where Libya is being paid a bribe I think that's a better word, by the Italian government to turn North African refugees or people that escaped through Libya around. And it was really tragic and mentally terroristic because there was a boatload of people. And they got, you know, put on the ship. And this young man was like, yes, Italy, yes, yes, yes. And the reporter's like, no, no, not going to Italy. And she was kind of laughing. But, you know, I was like, dang, you know, this man's full of joy because he thought he made it to freedom or whatever he thinks freedom is in Italy. And then in the distance, they zoom into a ship that's Italian, and it says, keep away. And it says it in English, and then it says it in, I suspect it's Arabic, you know. And that's it. I mean, I suspect this is a market reset for a lot of businesses, people, corporations that are in power. They're getting people in frenzies to shop for things they don't necessarily need, to hoard. You know, it's opportunity for people that wanted to invest in stock that didn't have the money at first, you know, and it's also a way to get rid of some businesses that were competitors that I guess people, you know, feel shouldn't have been competing. These non-white businesses and make some money on top of it. Like I said, some people's frenzy and then, you know, the population tailoring confusion. You know, I don't know what to believe, whether it's real or fake, but I mean, it's just something to see. And then with no ventilators, like the for-profit hospital should no longer be a discussion after this is solved. Like that needs to be gone with because if people are complaining on news that, hey, these co-payments that we had to pay, you know, they went up since this happened or, you know, we still got to pay deductibles to get seen, even though we're complaining about having coronavirus symptoms. Like, it should be free because it's happening all over. No, it's not. Not in the United States of America, where racism, white supremacy rules the day. So I hope everybody stays well, and thank you for letting me have some time to speak.
Yes, ma'am. Stay safe in Louisiana. Other folks, we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I
heard both of you. Let's get our Bay Area mom first.
Okay, sure. I'll be quick.
Is it college, possible for you to get a little bit closer to the speaker? It's like you're a little muffled. I'm not sure if you're on speakerphone or...
Okay, can you hear me now?
Much better, much better.
Yeah, my earphone died. Sorry. Okay, so my son, he's on the other line. He should be. I think I merged him in. And he can share his experience because I don't have any little children for me to be affected. It seems like he follows whatever the online curriculum is. And since his college is, I don't know if it makes a difference, however they're doing it in college. But are you on the line?
Yes, have you heard?
Clear. Good to hear from you, sir.
Thank you. So I went to a college in Boston and they made the announcement that we were supposed to be sent home March 18th. We had that announcement less than a week before. So we have to hurry and figure out storage and plane tickets and everything. It was just a hectic ride and nobody could really help us. The only thing they helped us with was storage stuff and the prices for that were off the charts. For example, just for them to take the package and then deliver it back if you were on campus, one large box was $75, so that was tough for me, but I had around four or five boxes, so I could only ship one, and I just let my friends deal with the rest. So coming back home, I realized there's a lot of mishaps with me doing online college. For example, private instruction is difficult. For those who don't know, I go to a music school, so the curriculum is much different online than at a regular university or liberal arts college. So we have stuff like private instruction and ensemble that requires
in-person meetings that wouldn't be accomplished, but we're still trying to do it. There's certain classes that are changed around just because we are online. For example, a lot of studio classes have to be online. A lot of liberal arts stuff has to be online. It's less of a problem, but yeah. For this mishap, there's a lot of people who are affected by just cost and just lack of access to the college. For example, I'm in a keyboard class and I don't have a working keyboard, and I just bought mine and it's coming to order in about a week or so, which is basically leaving me behind about 2 weeks. And I'm the only one in the class that doesn't have a keyboard, working keyboard at all. So I'm probably one of the most dedicated students, but also the school is limiting me with my access. When I was on campus, I had much more accessibility to stuff like keyboards and teachers and stuff like that. But now that not only do I have lack of access to materials, but I have to get up earlier since I'm going from Boston to California, which is about a 3-hour difference. That's one of the problems for me, and it's a problem for a majority of the student population, because they're coming from, let's say, Korea, China, Japan, Europe, other parts of the United States, maybe the Caribbean, and they have to deal with those different time zones. And those are some of the problems for us. We did get a small reimbursement for our tuition, but it was only $700 out of how much did we pay this semester? Around $30,000. We're supposed to be getting a prorated housing thing as well, if we were on campus, just to help with next semester housing. Currently, we don't know when we're supposed to be coming back to campus. It might be September, it might be May. We're not entirely too sure yet, but I'm hoping for the best. If we do come back to campus on May, I might take that opportunity rather than spending the summer back home, just because it might put me back on track with being on campus and everything. But other than that, yeah, that's pretty much what's going on with me and the rest of the campus.
Wow. Devastating to hear, but wow. Our young scholar in the Bay Area, we have heard from him before. Like, I'm having the same experience. Some people with justice, like, oh, wow, like, he's all grown now. But wow, that is, I cannot imagine being on the other side of the country and then you're just told with less than a week's notice, you got to get all this stuff packed up and shipped or in storage and get out of here, and then get all the way to the other. Wow, that is difficult days, man. And the uncertainty, that's where so many people are, that uncertainty about not knowing, are we going back later on? Are we going to be going back in the fall? Are we going back in May? Like, man, document. I would maybe even journal during all this, because it's such an extraordinary time. It's just documenting what you're going through. Like, quite a journey. I will check in with your mom, see how things are going as all of us try to get through this the best way we can. But I guess if anything, might be good to be away from the East Coast, since they're talking about quarantining that region. Like, man. Let's see. Other folks. Oh, wait a minute. Draftomania, that was you simultaneously, yes?
Yes, sir. Just real quick, follow up on what M. Hodges was saying. I did send out
your volume is low. If you could get closer to the speaker or speak up.
Okay. Follow up on what M. Hodges was saying.
Not hearing you at all now? Not hearing you at all now?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, can you hear me now? I pressed my mute button by accident. Can you hear me now?
Still pretty low, but yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I was saying that
a Forbes magazine article was stating that with Imhon Gusey was saying about the Harvard scientists is doing some testing to block out the sun, and the project is called Stratospheric Control Perpetration Experiment. And they were supposed to spend $3 million to test their models by launching a steerable balloon in the southeast U.S. 20 kilometers into the stratosphere. Once the balloon is in place, it will release small particles of calcium carbonate. Plants are in place again. The launch as early as the spring of 2019, but it started this in 2019. So they have been doing testing because they were supposed to be trying to... scientists and government agencies are trying to do some experiments for the environmental groups are trying to block out the emissions of gas and trying to cool off the atmosphere. So, he's correct in his assessment when he says that they are doing plans in the atmosphere to cool off the earth and block out the sun. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Racists conduct a lot of experiments. Were there other folks that we missed totally? Other folks that we have not heard from at all?
Greetings, Gus.
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, and greetings to everyone. If Mr. Obama was president, the only thing I could think about is very complicated it would be for himself and his care group. I don't know of any time in history where something of this magnitude took place and a non-white black person was in the CEO position of an area where the vast majority of the people were white. So it's hard to really get something accurate on that question, other than the best thing I can think about is his situation would be very, very much complicated. The accelerants of danger on his personal behalf as well as his family would also be complicated. I have an offspring that targeted to be a graduate this coming summer. He also works right now, as we speak. He is at Amazon. Basically, the code that I have between myself and him is when he comes home in the morning, in and around 6:30 a.m., something like that, he basically decontaminates himself by taking off of, you know, all of his clothes and putting them in the hamper and showering before he takes a rest. That's what we've been practicing. So that's basically what we have been doing, during that particular time. As far as when he graduates, I don't know if it would be a disadvantage or advantage. He's in college to be a teacher. So I don't know what kind of situation it would be in the public school system. There is no foreseeable date on when that would become reestablished as far as school in the way that we know it. I would say that include that there is still large groups of people who are not taking it serious. And I would say, based on the history in this part of the world, the people in this part of the world that's called the quote-unquote United States is not used to war-like conditions. on a daily basis. The only time they would start taking it serious is when they start seeing temporary morgues on each corner, and also crematories where people are being burnt because it's not enough space to be burying people, and plus it may not be conducive to stopping the issue. Then there may be some people who would take the conditions serious from that standpoint. Hopefully it doesn't go to that level at all. But that's when I would say that they probably would start taking it serious. And that's my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Anybody that we missed and call us with a hand up that we missed completely? We got them all. Didn't miss anybody. All righty. We will be here Monday. Minimum, as I said, we should have at least one white guest, and it might be multiple. And I believe they are in the Oregon area, West Coast. But these white female educators, they wrote this. It's supposed to be like a workbook for educators dealing with young racist children and how to neutralize them before they become racist woman, racist man. They wrote it. This was published before all of the COVID-19 Chinese disease thing, but it was this year. It was just a few weeks ago. We played the report on one of the compensatory call-ins. We should have the authors with us this coming Monday. Always love questioning white people. Say that consistently. Talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. White women teachers. And that's who will be here on Monday. So we can take some of this time, turn off the Netflix, get some constructive questions in for whites, suspected racists. With that, I will say again, I hope people using this time and energy to do some constructive activities, get some reading in, plotting for the rest of 2020 for people who are having difficulties, which is lots of folks worldwide, doing as much as you can to try to get through all of this, minimizing your anxiety. Hopefully you have some Wi-Fi service and what have you, so you can at least try to look for resources and helpful information to help make sense of all this. If it's trying to make sense of what your child's academic plan is going to look like for the rest of the year, making sense of your finances and career options for the rest of the year, cumulative, could be lots of things happening. Hopefully we'll be able to kind of keep our wits, plow through this, and navigate it as best we can. We will be here on Monday, hopefully to help with a little bit of sanity and help us follow logic. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, normal broadcast time. With that, much obliged to all the folks who participated. Hopefully it was worthy of your Saturday evening, especially under these conditions. Can only say that again. This time, you know, we could have been watching the news, you know, figuring out what's going on. Is there going to be another quarantine in the area? Are they going to shut down the East Coast as they've been talking about planning maybe? So we definitely do not want to be wasting time. If you are at home, if you're in shelter, what have you, try to be as constructive as possible with what you are doing. We are still under a system of racism, white supremacy. So, yeah, that should be at the forefront of our thinking at all times. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I was at the grocery store, and it was like 2 days ago, or maybe even longer than that. It was a while ago, this week. But I saw a white man. I was going to the grocery store. He was exiting the liquor store, which is considered an essential business. And he had like a gallon of like vodka and whiskey, and he just looked so happy with these big, bulky, mega jugs of spirits, as they call it. Essential. Gotta have that to get through the crisis here. Maybe that helps stop the Rona. Protect your brain computer. Sobriety would be best in addition to being sober. shouldn't be driving too many places. But if we are out and about, maybe you have an essential job at the liquor store or wherever. If you are in your vehicle, still want to be buckled, especially under these conditions. If you are behind the wheel, you are sober, buckled up, and definitely not on the cell phone. Again, you do not, under these conditions, we already said, historic rise, more guns purchased than even when Obama became president. You do not want to be reckless, uncodified in an environment where you have a lot of stressed, anxious, armed race soldiers. You already got enough worries. Am I going to be stopped? Are they going to be, you know, harassing me about what are you doing out of the house? Do you have paperwork designating yourself as an essential employee and all the rest of it? You at minimum don't want to be stopped. Oh, because you weren't buckled up or you were playing on your phone or with the rest of it. Minimize contact with race soldiers under these conditions, especially badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.